We are live. It is another episode of the Joel and Blair Show. It is the 20th of March, 2023. And this evening, instead of an energy drink, I got raw milk. And basically, I just drink a bit of the raw milk down. And then I go to the coffee machine and just make some like espresso shots. And then I dump the espresso shots inside my 1 liter of raw milk, give it a bit of a shake. Boom, iced coffee. And apparently this is better for me, according to all of these concerned trolls, than getting my caffeine through Monster Zero Ultra. So, I've been longhoused. I've been longhoused into the iced coffee. But it's pretty good actually. It tastes good, and I like when we get the raw milk in, I do drink quite a lot of milk. I'm a big milk guy. So it's tasty, it's nice. So that's what I'm ready to send it this evening. And I'm obviously joined by Blair Cottrell, my esteemed co-host. How are you doing this evening?
I've gone the complete opposite route. I've got some weird concoction, energy drink powder. It's supposed to be a series of nootropics. Nootropic is this term they use these days to cover this broad range of substances that are supposed to enhance your capacity for thinking, understanding, what do they call it, cognition. It doesn't seem to really do anything though. I think the main ingredients are caffeine and alpha GPC. I'm not really sure what that is. I can't be bothered looking it up. But I do agree that just a nice shot of espresso is probably better for your digestion, probably better for your gut. But I know some people who think caffeine's like the worst thing for your gut. They think it's the worst thing in the world and they take a big stand against it. Caffeine is okay though. Like, as long as you're not drinking the amount of caffeine where it becomes vasoconstrictive. Actually, in low to moderate doses, caffeine has been shown to be a vasodilator, meaning it helps with blood flow. But when you start drinking too much of it, when you go above 400, 500 milligram doses in one hit, it has the opposite effect. It constricts your blood vessels, makes it harder for your heart to move blood around your body. So that's worth knowing, I think, about caffeine. How much does the average espresso shot have in it typically? How much caffeine? Usually between 80 and 100 milligrams, I think. And that's a good place to start. But I didn't
Well,
start
I
drinking
definitely
caffeine
drink way too
until
much
like
caffeine.
27.
I got to cut down. I dumped three espresso shots in this, by the way, because I'm a lunatic. But yeah, maybe that explains why my cardio could use a little bit of work. Maybe I'm too vasoconstricted. Maybe I've got to ease off on the caffeine.
Maybe.
But I don't know. Anyway, let's get into the show, I guess. Oh, I probably should mention as well. I saw this morning, I did listen to most of it. I didn't listen to all the super chat section, but Tom Sewell was on with Mark Collette this morning on Collette's program, and it was pretty good. So I think for those of you who are interested in getting some Tom content now that he's not on the show with us every week, which is obviously a temporary situation due to a legal situation. You can go get some Tom Sewell content. It was nice to see Collette and Sewell do a stream because I think they had a little bit of a tiff many years ago, but it seems like they're all made up now and we're all friends again. So that's nice. And I'll actually be going on with Collette Sunday night UK time, which will translate to Monday morning Australian time this Monday coming. So to do a show with Collette about. Well, broadly speaking, about the essay that I wrote on National Socialism in response to Keith Woods. And I actually had a bit of a debate with Greg Johnson. I put up the audio on my Telegram for those who want to listen to that earlier this week. And I don't think Collette wants to debate me. I think Collette just wants to have a kind of open discussion because I don't think he's as resistant to my position as Greg Johnson is, or as Keith Woods is. So it should be an interesting discussion. I enjoy that subject a lot. And yeah, so check out for that. I'd like to actually debate Keith himself. Elijah Schaefer did propose hosting a debate between us. I don't know if Keith wants to do it or not, but I'd like to do it. I think it would be a great spectacle. And I think it's a topic that we should just keep discussing and keep analyzing because clearly it's a topic that I wouldn't say divides the scene. There's more of a spectrum of positions. But it's obviously one of the hot topics within the nationalist scene, internationally and nationally. And it's something that therefore requires, I think, a lot of good faith and nuanced intellectual debate so that we can get to the bottom of, you know, whose position makes sense and why and what arguments stack up and what don't. So healthy, gentlemanly discussion, debate, open discourse on these kinds of subjects is very important for the nationalist movement. So I'll be on Colette's show on Monday morning, Australian time, as I said. Sunday night if you're in England. I guess Sunday afternoon or midday if you're in America. But
yeah. The audience fully understands, what is it, what is, like, in summary, the short answer, what's the position you represent and what's the alternative position?
Well, in the debate with Keith Woods, Keith's essay was why nationalism doesn't need national socialism. So his argument was that rehabilitating national socialism is a frivolous or unnecessary exercise, that it's a distraction, will undermine the movement. And he kind of made, in my opinion, an incoherent argument. In one part of his essay, he was saying that basically the stigma and around that national socialism casts upon nationalism has kind of faded in the contemporary era, and you know, it's no longer as much of a specter over politics. But on the other hand, he was saying that it is such an intense stigma that we don't want to be try to use our resources and our efforts to rehabilitate it. And it's like, well, you can't have both of those positions. It's like either the stigma is there and it's playing a role, and if you acknowledge that, then basically your position is either going to be that it's impossible to overcome that stigma, and so we basically have to constantly cuck ourselves into explaining how we aren't Nazis when we do our nationalism, or the stigma has faded, in which case, then what's the issue? But he also made a couple other arguments. One was that it would alienate Slavic people because of the anti-Slavic attitudes of the German National Socialists. He basically argued that National Socialism really has nothing to do with contemporary nationalism, that all of the characteristics that are in National Socialism that we might like or find desirable in the 21st century, they aren't specific to National Socialism. And so the project of rehabilitating it is unnecessary to focus on. We should just focus on our own native nationalist movements in the 21st century. And my response, I responded to his arguments at the end of my essay, but I began by putting forward the reasons why I take my position, which is that National Socialism needs to be rehabilitated. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily everyone needs to call themselves National Socialists, but at the very least, National Socialism needs to be rehabilitated, that it needs to be defended, and we need to change the discussion so that it can be looked upon in an open way, rather than people being closed-minded and anything that sounds too similar to the Nazis is immediately, you know, ejected from political discussion or sensible discourse or something. And my three core arguments were this. Number one, that nationalism isn't really an ideology. It's just an idea. It's an idea that has been mixed with many other ideological strains, and that what National Socialism is taking the idea of nationalism and purifying it into a fully cohesive ideology that ejects all liberal qualities and other qualities from it, and is a pure form of nationalism.
When you say purify, what does that entail? How do you purify something to a being? And what does that mean? What are you doing to nationalism by purifying it?
Well, what it means is that National Socialism begins with the premise of the nationalist idea, and then it reasons from that premise. Whereas nationalist movements, and Australia had a liberal nationalist movement, and most Western countries had liberal nationalist movements of various kinds prior to the First World War in particular, but also prior to the Second World War in most countries. But a lot of European countries started building these illiberal fascist or national socialist style third positionist movements in that time period. But before then, most nationalist movements were liberal, and therefore they were committed to a whole series of liberal ideas, and they weren't purely just concerned with the nationalist idea as a fundamental ideological premise. So they had a whole bunch of other commitments, which I would say are not nationalist. And then the second part of my argument, which builds from that first part of the argument, is that nationalism and liberalism were two movements that were allied with one another in many ways from the late 18th century to the early 20th century. But what was discovered in the early 20th century was that there are actually two sets of ideas that have contradictory core commitments. And so they turned against one another. And that's what the development of National Socialism and fascism is, and what the post-World War II international order is, where liberalism has completely ejected nationalism from itself and has become an anti-nationalist ideology in its essence. And so this is an argument against trying to build hybrid liberal nationalist movements now in the 21st century, that is out, that we can't do that anymore, basically, because the contradictions have realized themselves in history, and now you have to pick a side between liberalism and nationalism. And that's a problem if you want to say, if you're an Australian and you say, oh, we don't need to focus on any movements in any foreign countries, we can just focus on the Australian nationalist movement. Now, what I'm not saying is that we shouldn't learn about our own nationalist movement, that we shouldn't take inspiration from our own nationalist movement. Of course we should. But we need to also make modifications to the nationalism that Australia had prior to World War II, because it was embedded within a liberal ideological framework, and that framework ultimately facilitated the destruction of nationalism in Australia, the importation of foreign races, Jewish subversion, the integration into the American-led international order, the globalization of trade networks that we're now integrated in, where we no longer really have sovereignty, where all our biggest companies are majority foreign-owned, and we've become dependent more and more on international trade. And, we've completely become deracinated, et cetera. So that needs to be recognized. And the nationalist movements in Europe, particularly the National Socialist Movement as the flagship movement of that time period that turned nationalism against liberalism, we need to look to them and take some inspiration from them and take some of their characteristics into our nationalism, so that we can develop a liberal form of nationalism that can basically address the crisis that we're now in, which is going to require, in my opinion, an openness to dictatorship, an openness to more radical racial policies, more radical anti-Semitic policies, etc., than what liberal nationalist movements have historically been able to achieve and what would be realistic for them to achieve in the modern era. So, and then thirdly, I also talked about Germany's unique historical role and how Germany isn't just another country. People say, well, why are you taking an ideology from Germany? We're not German. And what I basically explain is that Germany is unique in European history and Western history as one of the greatest nations of the modern world, and that they're responsible primarily for resisting the development of liberalism in European history. That where, the three great powers basically of Europe at that time, the early modern period, were France, Britain, and Germany. And then you also have America and the Soviet Union. Obviously, the Soviet Union fell under communism, and Britain, France, and America were all liberals. Germany resisted liberalism. It resisted a lot of these forces in modernity from a philosophical standpoint, cultural standpoint, that generated liberalism, and it entrenched itself in with a very robust nationalist and traditionalist orientation, and from that basis tried to protect Europe at large from falling under liberalism or falling under communism. And so we should look to Germany as kind of the protectors of Europe, from a spiritual, cultural, philosophical, and political standpoint, is my argument. So of course we should be taking ideas from the Germans, because the Germans were trying to resist the very forces that have now consumed our entire civilization. So we should look to the Germans for leadership. And in the mid-20th century, a lot of the countries of Europe allied themselves with Germany against the encroachments of the Soviet Union on one side and liberal powers on the other side, because they too wanted to be liberated from Europe being ruled by liberal globalism or communist globalism, which are both destructive forces to our race. And so, whatever specific disputes, I don't believe that we should be anti-Slavic. I think modern genetic research has shown that Slavic peoples, particularly from northeastern Europe, are far more genetically similar to people from Northwestern Europe, like so-called Germanic peoples or Celtic peoples, than particularly Germanic peoples, than had previously been understood in traditional racial science, like before, you know, genetic modeling became as advanced as it is today. And so I think we should recognize that, you know, they're our kinsmen, they're much more closely related to us than people maybe thought back then, and be less hostile. And also, there's also a necessity, I think, for all European peoples to come together under current conditions, because back prior to the Second World War, the non-white nations of the world were way less comparatively powerful, economically, militarily, etc. And also, the percentage of the global population that was white was way higher than it is today, way, way higher. So the competition between different European powers was more significant back then, where now, you know, we're actually in a far worse position as a race. It's necessary for us to kind of get over historical differences and build a kind of pan-white, pan-European alliance, I think, against our various racial enemies. And so, you know, we can kind of open things up a little bit to a more pan-European form of national socialism. And that's actually what has happened in the National Socialist Movement since World War II. It has become more pan-European. It has spread to countries outside of Germany. In fact, the National Socialist Movement is probably more successful in Slavic countries like Ukraine or Russia or the Baltic states than it is in Germany itself at this point. In contemporary terms, and that's partly because it's very repressed in Germany, but it's also even more repressed, arguably, in Russia, yet it's still more popular there because they see it as an anti-Soviet ideology, and obviously they all hate the Soviet Union for historical reasons and logical reasons because the Soviet Union was a fucking monstrosity. So anyway, like, the point is that there's a, on that Slavic issue that Keith brought up, there's some nuance to be brought in there, but we're not hostile to Slavic people, at least I'm not. And I know that I don't think you are, Blair, and I don't think, you know, Jacob Hursten isn't. And, you know, we're not as a movement hostile to Slavic people, even if, you know, there's been some banter or certain remarks over the years. So anyway.
Even though they're insane, even though Slavs are generally insane, we love them. We love you guys. Who's the craziest breed of Slav? I've got to say the Serbs. The Serbians are the craziest. The Croatians are the most relatable. The Bosnians are just like aliens. And the Serbs are just absolutely crazy. That's my experience with Slav.
The people from the Balkans, they might identify as Slavs, but they're kind of... yeah, like when we're talking about in this context, we're talking about like Polish people, we're talking about Russians, we're talking about Ukrainians, things like that. Maybe a bit more so than like Balkan people from the Balkans, which are the kind of their own thing as well. But I think Jacob made a good point because like the thing is as well, Slavic isn't really like a pure like racial determination because it's like a linguistic determination. It's like the Slavic language family. But obviously, race and linguistics don't completely line up super perfectly. So anyway, like that's a whole can of worms I don't really want to go into. But I think Jacob said it well when he said... Is there
a determination of humanity in any expression?
Well, I think categorizing people by race, like in like a genetic way, is a more accurate way than by language because... Obviously, people of different groups can learn different languages or they've conquered different groups. And so the way that languages distribute, it does actually say a lot about history. And there is correlations between linguistic groups. Like, for example, we speak English, which is a Germanic language. It has some Latin characteristics, but it's a Germanic language, as is Dutch, as is Swedish, as is German, etc. And you can hear a lot of if you know anything about those languages, you can hear a lot of similarities. You know, you can actually listen to someone speak Dutch and kind of understand what they're saying as an English speaker. So a lot of words are actually quite similar.
Parallel with the degradation of the race, you often find the language degrades itself as well. Meaning the more a race suffers, if they were the original speakers of a certain language, their language starts to break down as the race does. And it's been my observation that it's almost like we're geared to speak and understand certain dialects genetically. people who can learn our language and turn over sentences with our words, they don't often have the same depth of understanding of the words of the language itself as we do, because it's a language that came from us. It came from who we are, came from our genetic predispositions. But we talked about the debate between you and Keith Woods last week to some depth. And my summary was that I believe that National Socialism basically takes nationalism and turns it into a gang that is geared for the practical application of nationalism, rather than just talking about nationalism, sitting around in clubs and arguing about it on social media or something. So I kind of agreed with you when you said that nationalism must inevitably become National Socialists, maybe not in outward form. It doesn't have to call itself that, but it does need to adopt that form in order to practically apply itself in the community and change culture.
And what that concretely is nationalism turning against liberalism, because like Schmidt talks about how liberalism is basically an ideology that is kind of built around the notion of talking and negotiating, right? Liberalism is like, well, let's have a parliament and then we vote in the representatives and they debate all the issues and we'll have free speech and everyone will debate all the issues. And there's like a, everything is built around protecting people's property rights so that they can participate in a market where everyone negotiates, you know, each other's position, whether it be economically or politically within the society. And, you know, this kind of, whereas the idea of nationalism, the idea of popular sovereignty is the idea that a people are sovereign. There's at a certain point, there's nothing to discuss. Like our existence as a people and our sovereignty as a people isn't up for debate. So I don't want to subject it to debate. Now, I'm happy to have freedom of speech and debate up to a certain level around many different issues. And the Nazis were not, they didn't like, it wasn't like this totalitarian cliche that is sometimes presented where you couldn't disagree with the government on anything. But the Nazis, they did ban Jewish free speech, for example. They said, if you're Jewish, you can't own media companies, you can't be part of the public discussion. Or if you're a foreigner, you can't own media companies, you can't be part of the discussion. Only Germans can have a conversation about what we're going to do in Germany. And if you're a Marxist, you're declared yourself an enemy of the nation, you're not going to be able to organize your Marxist party and try and overthrow us because you've declared yourself. So we're not interested in hearing your opinion either. So, you know, it was a controlled discussion between people who could agree on the first principles of nationalism. If you can agree on the first principles of nationalism, you're a member of the nation and you're loyal to the nation. Okay, well, now we can have a discussion about everything else, right? And that is what I believe in. I don't believe in opening up freedom of speech to the point that all these foreigners and Jews and subversives, people who hate our country, are all participating in the political discourse equally, and they all get representatives in our government as well. Fuck them. I'm not interested in them. They shouldn't have representation in our government. We're sovereign.
All these people do. Well, if we remember, we think back to one of my favorite lectures by Yuri Bezmenov. Everyone knows this lecture pretty well. If you don't, you should look it up. Yuri Bezmenov, I'm pretty sure it's still somewhere on YouTube. He was a defector from Soviet Union. He used to work for, I think, some sort of press agency, but then he also worked for intelligence in Soviet Union. And he says that what subversives in the world, or people who are looking to undermine and take advantage of your country, what they're looking for is a receptive target. And the kind of countries that they're going for are the countries that enshrine things like free speech in their constitution or just in their general policy, government policy, because people from other countries will come into your country and take advantage of the fact that there is freedom of expression. And they'll use it to gain power and control in your country. And then the first thing they'll do once they have appropriate amount of control is cancel free speech, especially any speech which criticizes them. And that's exactly what's happened in Australia. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying. You need some sort of sensible protection or boundary which prevents foreign subversives from buying and controlling your national institutions and even your government. That's just common sense, but apparently it was too much common sense for recent history or politicians in Australia's recent history.
Well, in Australia, we have our constitutional right to political communication is distinct from, it's not like an American style First Amendment. What it's derived from is that in the Constitution, it says that Australia will have representative government. So in the idea of representative government is the idea that the people are being represented. Well, how can the people be represented if they can't express themselves and like their political views so that their representatives can hear what the people, what their concerns are, what their interests are, et cetera? It's not possible for them to be represented because there's no mechanism of communication. So that's where the High Court derived our right to political communication from, which all these new laws are actually violations of. And, you know, we're going to the High Court. We're going to fight this ourselves. Other groups are going to the High Court. And there's going to be a lot of very interesting legal battles coming up, that some of them of which we're going to be involved in personally, to determine, does that right to political communication still exist? But when the Australian Constitution was framed, the founders, they wanted to put in basically the white Australia policy into the Constitution. They wanted to limit citizenship only to the white race.
Why didn't they do that?
They were blocked from doing so by the British. The British Parliament would not have signed off on the Constitution because if it was explicitly racist, they said you can make laws to create your white Australia policy, but do not put it in the Constitution because it's going to offend non-white countries, and we're trying to build business relationships and alliances with the Japanese.
We should have gone to war with England. When they refused to sign off on that, we should have gone to war with them like the Americans did.
Absolutely. In retrospect, we should have, right? But at the time, it didn't seem people felt a lot more trusting, and they didn't want to break away from the empire because they thought, well, we don't want to lose the empire. They've got all this great military might, particularly.
No, man, fuck the empire. We came to Australia in order to break away from the empire. Like, I mean, look at the empire now.
Well, it's gone now. It's gone now, right? But that's the history. And yeah, I agree. Obviously, in retrospect, we should have broken away like the Americans did and created a racial constitution. That's what we're going to have to do now. But now it's going to be more a case of breaking away from the Americans rather than from the British, because we're really more of an American protectorate than part of the British Empire at this point, obviously. But that was the original idea. If you had that, if the Constitution only allowed citizenship to go to whites, and then we would have, there wouldn't have been such a big deal with free speech. And what, you know, Chris Minns, I mean, I'll play the clip. He actually said this, by the way, this is the Premier of New South Wales. And he actually said this, I'm sure a lot of people have seen this clip, but it's worth playing because it's important. He actually said this a month or so ago. And I remember talking about it on the show, I think, at least I talked about it online. And he's reiterated it. So anyway, we'll listen to this.
There's been some that have been agitating in the parliament to nullify the laws, to remove them off the statute books. Think about what kind of toxic message that would send to the New South Wales community. And I think the advocates for those changes need to explain, what do they want people to have the right to say? What kind of racist abuse do they want to see or be able to lawfully see on the streets of Sydney? I recognise, and I've fully said from the beginning, that we don't have the same freedom of speech laws that they have in the United States. And the reason for that is that we want to hold together a multicultural community and have people live in peace, free from the kind of vilification and hatred that we do see around the world.
It's fucking gaslighting hard, as though all criticism of a certain ethnic community must always be vilification and hatred just by default. We're looking to protect legitimate criticism and freedom of expression in that regard. No one's trying to protect the right to vilify. Or what does that even mean anyway? The problem with these laws is,
I think we should have the right
any
to vilify.
Criticism of any community can be essentially deemed vilification or hatred and made illegal. Chris Minns knows that. He's just fucking gaslighting.
The word vilify, all it means is to speak or write about someone in an abusively disparaging manner.
So exactly how like journalists write about us.
Denigrate. So basically,
we're the ones being vilified. No one gets vilified more than white Australians and people who are active in support of a white Australia.
Hmm. Well, of course, but like you should have the right to vilify. Like if you think a particular group is up to no good, and you talk about it, and you don't like not liking another group in your country is a form of political expression. So if we have political expression, if we have representative government, if you and I, Blair, are going to be represented, if the people who watch this show are going to be represented in politics, well, we don't like some of the groups in our country. We don't want the Jews here. We don't want the Indians here. We don't want the blacks here. We don't want any of these fucking people here. We don't like them. We want them out.
The basis for us not wanting
them. That's our politics. So we can't be represented unless under these laws. So basically, liberal democracy doesn't exist unless you agree with multiculturalism. That's what he's saying. He's saying you have no right to disagree with multiculturalism. You have no right to be represented if you disagree with multiculturalism. In order to preserve the project of multiculturalism, basically it has to be illegal to criticize it.
But the basis for us not wanting other ethnicities in our country in large numbers isn't just because we don't like them. I mean, that's got nothing to do with it, really. It's more about ensuring that our race has a future, a living space, a culture of its own. Pretty simple stuff, common sense sort of shit, really. I mean, I like Japanese culture. I'm kind of fascinated by it, but I don't want to import it and put it in my country. I don't want it to spread and become a dominant culture in my country. It's like, it's not about whether I like it or not. It's about the survival of my own kind. And that should be common sense, but to people like Chris Minns and a lot of other major party politicians, they just can't make sense of it. Everything like that's racist also, because it's what they're brainwashed, hoodwinked into thinking, right?
But also it's completely legitimate not to like it. Like, do you like Indian culture?
I don't really know anything about it, but the thing is I don't really want to know. I know that they eat a lot of curry and they walk around in dresses and thongs and stuff, but I don't care to know any more than that. If I one day become interested in Indian... If I one day become more interested, I'll go to India and check it out. But, like, I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to have to decide whether I like it or dislike it because it's being forced down my throat, obviously. So I don't really have any feelings about it. That's the honest truth. I don't know enough about it.
Well, this is what I said when I went on Jake Shields. He's like, so what, you're saying you don't really hate other races, you just want to have your own country? And I was like, well, look, if you don't want me to hate other races, stop shoving them in my fucking country. Because that's what's going to make me hate them, is being forced to give my country to them. If they were kept in India, if every single Indian was in this faraway land that I had nothing to do with, I wouldn't feel any real strong particular emotion about them because they wouldn't be relevant to my life.
Can we just agree, though, that Chris Minns is kind of, you know, this is an emperor has no clothes moment. He's openly admitting that the reason freedom of speech can't exist, the reason you cannot freely express yourself, believe or think what you want to believe or think, is because multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is more important than your freedom. Protecting multiculturalism is more important than human rights. It's more important than your expression. It's more important than your national history. It's more important than you. They use multiculturalism and the chaos it creates as a premise for total control. And that's what it's been about from the beginning. You think this is a mistake? People say multiculturalism hasn't worked. It's been a failed experiment. It's worked. It's done exactly what it was supposed to do, which is more power to government, less power for the people. And, like, that's exactly what's playing out right now. Chris Minns is just standing there admitting that. Hey, we forced multiculturalism on you to take away your rights and take over your country. And now that's what we've done, and you can't do anything about it, Goy. Fuck you. That's essentially what they're doing now. They're admitting it. So anyone who still can't see that, anyone who's still like, oh, you're a racist, pointing their finger, screaming abuse at other people for not accepting beautiful, harmonious, multicultural society, you're an idiot. You're an idiot. You're playing right into their hands.
This is also what I was saying in my essay when I was quoting Schmidt, talking about how liberalism and nationalism, they used to be synthesized into a formula that existed in Australia before World War II and in many other places. But that formula has been ruptured and they're now oppositional. And Schmidt predicted this in the 1920s that this would happen, which is why his essay is very important to read. And what he was saying is that the idea of democracy is the idea of popular sovereignty, the idea that a particular people are sovereign over their own nation. And he says that this idea is fundamentally incompatible with the idea of liberalism, which is the idea that no matter who you are, you have certain rights within a political order, that there's a contract called a constitution, and there's a set of laws and principles that even if you're a minority, even if you aren't part of the majority, even if the majority don't like you or want to gang up on you, you get protected so that they're not allowed to basically assert their will over you. So that's a really great system if you're a Jew or if you're a capitalist that you know, parasitizes off you know, the well-being of a country that wants to basically profit off violating the national interest. And so what basically Schmidt was saying is that liberalism implies a heterogeneous society, a society composed of many different elements, and it protects all the minority elements from being removed or overpowered by the majority, whereas the idea of democracy, properly understood, would be the majority overpowering the minority. And so therefore, the idea of democracy really implies homogeneity. It really implies nationalism, that you can't really have sovereignty unless you have nationalism. Otherwise, how can you be sovereign? So liberalism, in realizing this after the Second World War, made protecting minorities and their rights against majorities its essential core constitutive feature. And it fundamentally changed itself in order to defend minorities against majorities as its primary task. And that supervenes upon all of its other, you know, all of its other values and concerns. And that's what multiculturalism is. It's every single minority group gets protections, except that the majority group doesn't get it. Like, try and use these laws to go after someone who's racist against the white person or talk shit about white people. I guarantee you that it's not going to fucking work. People should try and do it just to like prove that it doesn't work and like get it on record and create like a delegitimization of the system through the process. But that's what multiculturalism is. Multiculturalism is every culture except our culture, the Australian people. And it's everyone else gets represented by government except us. There's the Jewish community representatives, the Muslim community representatives, there's the Indians, there's the Chinese. Everyone gets to make representations to the government that they have to listen to and that they want to listen to, but not us. There's something called the British Australian community, which represents concerns of Anglo-Celtic Australians. The government's not listening to them. There's us. We represent white Australians. The government isn't listening to us. They're trying to put us in jail. They're trying to get us, they're banned. They coordinate to get us banned from social media. They don't want to hear from us. In fact, they want us to shut up. In fact, they would love us to maybe die, ideally. So that's what the system actually is. And that's why, you know, the response has to be the aggressive assertion of the will of white Australians, to assert it over the entire political order and completely remove all the other elements from our society. Because what Chris Minns is saying there is very clear. If the minority groups are going to be protected, that means the rights of the majority group have to be taken away. That means your sovereignty and your rights have to be taken away to make Australia hospitable to Jews and Indians and Chinese people, etc. Well, that's not acceptable. You know, the old idea that they were giving us was, oh, don't worry, you know, we can all be Australian and everyone can share the same values and they're just coming here because they want a better life and they're just as Australian as you or I and they love liberal democracy and our freedoms and you know, we're all the same. That was the old message that they were giving us. Well, that message was obvious bullshit. There's still some conservatives trying to peddle that idea, but it's obviously bullshit. This is the truth. The truth is this: either white people are going to be sovereign or white people are going to be discriminated against because we're too powerful. If we're allowed to play on a fair footing, if we get to have identity politics, white Australians, and get to play on the same footing as Aboriginals and Jews and all these groups, we'll destroy them. We'll defeat them. We'll take over the government and we'll win. So we have to be institutionally discriminated against to raise all the other groups up and let them rule and let their concerns be heard. And so it's either or. There's no amicable solution where we sit down and negotiate a compromise. Either we win or they win. Either we get the country or they get the country.
Look at the sort of laws that have been introduced or changed to try to stop white people, ethnically conscious white people, from demonstrating their perspective or just protesting politically. Like, all these symbols and gestures have been banned. You can't do a Roman salute, can't extend your arm out in front of you. Even if it's a joke, you'll be taken to court. Just like former Neighbours actor Damien Richardson, he's due to go to court for satirically, during a closed venue in a speech, doing kind of a mock Roman salute in order to draw attention to how ridiculous that law was. He's been charged for it, and now he needs to go to court. I need to try to catch up with that guy, actually, or someone who knows him, because I don't know what's going on with that, whether there's been any progress with that. But the point is, a great deal of effort has been made in the past 18 months to 2 years to try to stop conscious white people from protesting or, you know, making their will known, making their presence known in society. But one law change we've seen the government introduce recently, which is supposed to be the solution to all of this African crime, is outlawing machetes. That's happened, I think, in Victoria. Has it, Joel, or is that a nationwide? I think it's a Victoria thing.
It's a Victoria thing. The most of the blacks are here.
I found it funny because they're outlawing machetes. Okay. Machetes were already on the controlled weapons lists as part of the Controlled Weapons Act in Victoria. Australia has this notoriously long list of makeshift weapons or things that could be construed as a weapon. Even walking canes of a certain length and riding crops. If you don't have a horse or a good reason, you can't have a riding crop in your house because that's a controlled weapon. Police will confiscate it and you'll be charged with possession of a controlled weapon. Machetes were already on that list, obviously, but now apparently they've been upgraded to prohibited weapon, which is slightly more banned than it was before, apparently. And that's going to be the solution. Apparently, 17-year-old African gangsters, that's going to scare them into obeying this new law and stopping the machete wars on the streets of Melbourne. I found that hilarious. Obviously, they're not going to care about that. And it just goes to show how inept the government is, how useless they are at dealing with this problem, as though taking machetes from the Controlled Weapons Act and putting it on the Prohibited Weapons Act, that's the most they can do to try to curb this African street violence that they themselves, this government, through its immigration policy, have facilitated. They're responsible for this crime. Australians aren't responsible for it. We're just going to work and trying to be left alone. This government has imported all of these Africans into our country who are now chopping people up on the streets with machetes, breaking into people's homes, taking people's cars for joyrides, murdering people because they feel like it. And the solution, while the government's banning the Roman salute and all protest against this immigration policy, the solution the government's come up with for the African crime is to take machetes from the Controlled Weapons Act and put it on the prohibited weapons lists. Great job, Victorian government. Wow. Do we have a video or something, Joel, we can watch and react to regarding this?
Yeah, I just want to react to what you're saying. My proposal would be to put niggers on the prohibited weapons list. I think that would actually solve this whole issue, quite simply. But, you know, obviously it's already illegal to attack someone with a machete. So simply moving, you know, obviously they're already engaging in illegal activities. So simply classifying holding the machete as also illegal is really quite frivolous, right? Because they don't just want to hold it and walk around with it. They want to slash, you know, they want to fuck people up with it. So, you know, it's really about the intent. And it's not going to stop, like, you know, it's not going to stop them from getting their hands on them, obviously. So there's something about, like, the human condition. People will, no matter how many forms of weapons you ban, they will figure out a way. Humans will figure out a way to get new weapons. And then if we get down to the point where we're fighting just with our hands, you know, ultimately, if you knock someone to the ground and stomp on their head, you can still kill them, right? You can choke them out or something. There's still ways to fucking kill people with your bare hands. So, you know, in jail, they ban everything and they're checking everyone's butthole to see what's up there. And they're still killing each other in jail somehow. They're still figuring out a way. So there's never going to be a way to eradicate violence. But what you can do is eradicate the violent. That's my preferred solution.
How do you eradicate the violent without becoming violent yourself?
Well, you have to become, but you know, you become violent yourself against the violent. That's the only solution to violence is violence. But of course, legal.
It's almost like the only solution or the only protection society has against bad men is good men skilled at violence.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, or maybe it's bad men that are on your side. Maybe even that's another way of putting it. Bad men who are coming after you. You want to have badasses defending you, right?
I've always kind of wished guns didn't exist. I'm all for those, you know, how some people are like, you know, ban guns or whatever. That would obviously work out to the advantage of the government, and so I can't support it on those grounds. But can you imagine a world without guns? If all guns, cannons, bombs, artillery, if it all just vanished overnight? Could you imagine what would happen? Could you imagine like this gradual, back on... pretty fast change as to like where the, how the power structure would shift suddenly? Suddenly you would need to, you know how to use a blade in order to prove your right to hold power or authority over anybody. You know, that'd be a, an interesting society to live in.
Well, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why, you know, you can think about history in lots of different ways, but one way of thinking about history is just through the development of weapons technology. Basically, the reason why we have democracy is because guns were invented. Before guns were invented, you know, as you rightly point out, using blades of various descriptions or blunt trauma weapons, this requires the a lot of training in order to, and you can get a lot better. Whereas, like, obviously you train to use guns, but, you know, in the American Revolution, it's like a bunch of dudes with muskets, like, in a field. And so can you overthrow the British government? Well, how many dudes with muskets can you pull up against the redcoats? But back in the day, it was only the aristocracy had the time to cultivate, you know, basically a life of martial training in order to become adept on the battlefield. And so, you know, peasants were just way weaker than aristocrats because they didn't have the refinement. They didn't have the quality of weapons, but also they didn't have the refinement of skills. They didn't have a life of training. Maybe they weren't physically, you know, even capable. They weren't genetically capable of being skilled in the arts of war. And so that created a kind of natural aristocracy. And so we had aristocratic forms of government, right? But then once basically there's the great leveler of the gun, and it's just like you get like the trench warfare of World War One. It's like how many millions of guys can you stick in a trench to like take pot shots at each other and throw grenades at each other? It becomes about quantity rather than quality. And so the government becomes about quantity rather than quality as well, to reflect the change in weapons design. Now we don't really live in a true democracy. We live in more of an oligarchy because weapons are now being are now so technological that it's about how much money do you have. So like the it's not about how many men you can mobilize. If your enemy has nuclear weapons and drones and, you know, hypersonic missiles and you know, massive aircraft carriers and all this kind of stuff, obviously that costs a shitload of money, and it requires, you know, really big governments with lots of resources to develop that kind of technology over a long period of time. And so now we live in a world dominated by these giant oligarchic like techno empires. And so basically the kind of politics you get is always going to be a reflection of where weapons technology is at a particular time. And so you have to always adapt your politics basically to like where weapons tech is at. This is why I'm a nationalist, because I believe that Australia, if we liberated ourselves from the traitorous establishment we currently have and had like a national socialist government, because of our geography, because we live on this, you know, giant island, basically, all we would need, and I've talked about this before, all we would need is to develop a nuclear weapons program, which is actually quite easy because you can just say, oh, we're going to adopt nuclear power now, which is why I support nuclear power, even if the ZOG wants to implement nuclear power, we should support it because it puts us closer to a nuclear weapon. And you need a space program so that you can actually, you know, build rockets to attach nukes to potentially. And once your space program and your nuclear energy program is going pretty good, it doesn't take very much more work to then combine those two disciplines together and create, you know, nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles. Then also, if you just go to the major cities and you stick hypersonic anti-shipping missile defense systems, well, if anyone tries to invade Australia, what they would have to do basically is show up with a bunch of submarines and ships and try and invade from the sea to the land, which is extremely difficult to do. And so if we have sick, super fast, super high-tech anti-shipping ballistic missile systems around all of our major cities, good luck. You're going to get your shit absolutely rocked if you come too close. And, you know, with just those two things, Australia could become almost impervious to invasion, more or less. So Australia, because of our geography, has a unique ability to basically say fuck you under modern weapons technology to the rest of the world and lift ourselves out of being dependent upon larger powers. Like, you know, obviously that would require an economic policy to bring manufacturing back and so on. But we've got so much natural resource wealth in Australia that we're actually, we have a very good place to try and create national sovereignty. Like, a lot of other countries are just too small to be truly sovereign. They're dependent upon larger countries, and they have land borders with other countries that they need to defend. Like, if you have a land border with China or a land border with Russia or something, you know, you're not truly, like, how are you going to defend against them if they invade you? You're not going to be if you're a small country. You're going to need to become the bitch of some other larger country in order to stop them from invading you. Like, look what's happened to Ukraine, basically. It's hard for Ukraine to be a truly sovereign country because it either has to basically become dependent upon Europe and America, or it gets invaded by Russia, you know. And Australia is in a lucky position where we don't have those issues. That's why it's so important that we win in Australia, because if we win in Australia, we can genuinely have an independent white country. It's one of the only geographic places in the world where you can go your own way under current, you know, weapons technology. But anyway, that was a bit of a fucking rant.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? African machetes.
Yeah. I was asking if we had any sort of news clip, something we could watch and react to regarding this. Is there anything in the arsenal, or do we have to look something up?
Oh, did you want to look at the Channel 9 clip?
If there is one, yeah, we can see what they're saying about it.
Yeah, all right, I'll pull it up. Yeah, we'll get your. I haven't actually seen this clip, but I saw someone post it. It'd be interesting to see what.
Yeah,
how they present this story to the normie masses.
As the search continues for the people who killed a young man in Lyndhurst, the government is being asked why the machete ban will take 6 months to enforce. The opposition says the ousted chief commissioner recommended the change a year ago. Crime reporter Gillian Lantouris.
Bouquets of flowers marking another victim of Victoria's machete crisis. A 24-year-old man was stabbed to death in a Lyndhurst car park on Friday night. The offenders are believed to be linked to a violent armed robbery in Boronia an hour earlier. The car suspected of being used in both crimes, a white Hyundai Kona, stolen from Cardinia Life car park on Monday.
We need to get the machetes off the streets as fast as possible.
Police say up to 10 young men of African appearance are still on the run over the Clyde man's death. Nine News can reveal his death is the result of rising tensions between warring youth gangs in the southeast. Also linked, a home in Hampton Park and another in Narre Warren were peppered with bullets last month.
Enough is enough when it comes to crime here in our state.
Machetes will be outlawed in September, but many are asking why it'll take so long. The government says it has a lot to consider, including an amnesty process, as well as consulting industries to set up a permit system.
When the UK introduced this ban, it took them around 18 months. We intend to do that ban within 6 months.
The Chief Commissioner of Police, Shane Patton, mentioned to him over 12 months ago they could do something and they failed to act.
The ban will be the first of its kind in the nation.
We're calling on the federal government to enact a similar ban all the way around Australia.
But in Frankston this morning, the Prime Minister refused to weigh in.
Just in regards to the Bail and Machete laws again, do you believe these laws are enforced?
You know, federal leader. So, yeah, thanks.
Gillian Lantouris, Nine News.
Well, Albo's refusing to take shit at press conferences lately. But they didn't seem to need this long to consider the ban of the Roman salute or so-called Nazi symbols. They were all banned pretty quickly without any deliberation. And look, my... yeah, I know. Usually they don't mention Africans. Someone was just saying in the comments, I'm shocked they actually mentioned them as well. Usually they just say youths, but everyone knows that youths is like code word for African
niggers.
Murderers and thieves down here in Australia these days. But look, the determination I've come to by watching that video is if some guy was standing on the street doing a Roman salute, extending his arm out in front of him, and an African came along and cut his arm off with a machete, they would charge the guy doing the salute first with displaying a Nazi symbol. And then 6 months later, they might get the guy with the machete, maybe, if they had time. That's the situation down here in Victoria, it seems.
Well, and also, like, the magistrates have been trained to make sure that they don't, you know, give jail sentences to Africans because they might get deported, you know, so that would be sad. So we've got to make sure that we don't give them too serious sentences for chopping people up with machetes because then they'll get deported back to wherever the fuck they came from. You know, so that would be horrible because, you know, it's so vibrant. It's such the vibrant diversity of machete fights. And it was interesting as well that I noticed they also mentioned a house getting shot up, peppered with bullets. Aren't guns illegal? I thought when you make guns illegal, it means that magically criminals can't get guns anymore. Oh, wait. Criminals don't give a fuck about laws. They're criminals. Only law-abiding citizens obey laws. That's crazy. So I'm sure these Africans are going to be like, well, hey, Wabe, or whatever the fuck their name is. Don't you know that machetes are illegal now? You got to get rid of that thing, man. And they'll be like, oh, fuck, man. I don't want to break the law here. You know?
What am I going to murder these grannies with now? I can't use the machete anymore. Shit.
I mean, the one good thing about these machete fights is it seems to be blacks chopping each other up. And so, you know, the trash is taking itself out. So, you know, maybe we should, you know, more machetes, actually. Like, let's like expedite this process. Let's get these niggas chopped up. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Hey, careful with that, man.
I'm not saying I want to do it. I'm saying, if they want to do it, I'm not going to stand in their way. But yeah, look, I mean, the whole thing is a farce. And, like, look how they frame it, too. It's like the government is going to ban machetes. And then it's like, but they're not banning them quickly enough. Oh, like, you know, there's no one providing the alternative position of, like, well, how about we don't ban these things? Or, you know.
Well, did you hear what happened?
I don't contrive Australian political discourse.
They can't actually ban machetes immediately because there's certain things to add to the legislation for permits to be issued for certain reasons for people to have them. And then there's probably other things to consider that mortals like ourselves aren't thinking about because we're not, you know, illustrious law experts. But I just found it peculiar that those same considerations weren't made with extending your arm out in front of yourself. That was obviously banned straight away. Very little thought went into that could possibly be an expression from someone's culture, political expression. Maybe it could be, you know, there could have been some subcategory put in the law there. What do you call it? Like a little point beneath the major law saying that it can be done satirically as a joke, something like that. Nope, none of that was considered. It was banned straight away. But machetes, we have to give certain people rights and permits to use those sometimes. So we need to put some serious thought into the banning of machetes. But like I said, they were already essentially banned. They're on a controlled weapons act, but I suppose they're upgrading them to no one can have them for any reason without a permit now. But that's weird to me because that's the same way the Controlled Weapons Act works as well. You can have a collector's permit and still have knives that you don't actually
need. You don't need a permit to get a machete.
No, I think to hold one in your house, you're supposed to have a permit already. If it's a controlled weapon, you need to have a permit or you need to have some sort of viable excuse.
Okay.
Like you need to be going, you know, bush hiking or something and chopping down trees and, you know, prove that that's what you do for either a job or a hobby.
Police, I don't have any machetes in my house. Of course, they know that because they've raided my house like 8 times. So they know what I've got in my house.
Yeah. I think we've drawn enough attention to the absurdity of the situation and the double standard there, the usual double standard with how the law goes in Australia right now. But what's next on the agenda, my friend?
Yeah, I mean, there's the story that 200,000 foreign students arrived just last month because obviously university is back in for the year and that's a new record. There's not really much to say other than the government said they're going to bring, you know, the numbers down and the numbers have only gone up, which, you know, wow, that's a surprise. You know, I thought the government would be telling the truth. I can't believe they'd lie to us like that. How could they do that to us? There's not really much else to say there other than, you know, I thought this clip was actually, I'll play this clip actually. Blair's gone, so I'll play this clip for everybody.
I'm here. I was just turning the air conditioner on. It's really fucking hot. It's kind of like there's a lot of moisture in the air and it's just making me angry. So just got some.
Yeah, it's been a very humid day in Melbourne. Like there's been a lot of rain, but it's still been kind of warm, quite muggy, the energy. But anyway, here's Peter Dutton's ugly head. This is at the Lowy Institute. Frank Lowy is a Jewish billionaire. He, runs Westfield. I'm sure the people know Westfield. But Frank Lowy also is, I think, one of the largest donors, if not the largest donor, into basically foreign policy think tanks. So we've got this Jewish billionaire who runs all the shopping centers. And he puts his billing, he puts his money into these discussion forums and think tanks where they come up with what Australia's foreign policy is going to be. And then he goes and the Lowy Institute actually gets funding from the US State Department. So a foreign government and a Jewish billionaire work together to fund a an institute that can, where everyone gets together and discusses, all these elites get together and discuss, what is Australia's foreign policy going to be? So you can see how, you know, this is democracy in action.
Really,
this is how, yeah, this is how we're going to figure out what our national interest is, right? And so we're going to hear Peter Dutton talking about our national interest right here. This is a clip from his speech that he gave, I think, today or yesterday.
A Dutton coalition government will again put the national interest front and centre of our foreign policy. If I become Prime Minister, one of my first orders of business will be to call Prime Minister Netanyahu to build on the one-on-one meeting I had with him during my recent visit and to help rebuild the relationship Labor has trashed. Israel will be able to count on our support again in the United Nations.
So wait, our national interest, what the fuck does Israel have to do with Australia's national interest? It's on the other side of the world. What has Israel ever done for Australia? Can anyone even provide one example of Israel doing something useful to Australia? I've never heard anyone even bother to bring up an example.
Something useful to who? Useful to us or useful to them?
Yeah, but the way they torture this word, national interest, like, I don't feel very interested. You know, this is, so that's what Australia's national interest isn't like, how are we going to defend Australia from an invasion? How are we going to make Australia more self-reliant economically? How are we going to build up our military strength to confront, you know, our regional rivals? How are we going to secure our interests in Asia Pacific? No. How can we give Israel more support in the irrelevant conflict on the other side of the world that has absolutely nothing to do with us? Let's focus on that. Israel, a country, by the way, which has probably just launched a bunch of fucking psyops in our country to take away our freedom of speech. This is our great ally. This is our national interest. When a foreign country is trying to dictate to Australia what its policies are, what its laws are, that's apparently in Australia's national interest. But of course, how can you have a national interest if you're a multicultural country? Apparently, like, we don't get to actually have a nation in the first place. What a nation means is a people that share ancestors, a people that share a culture, that share a way of life. Well, we're a multicultural country. Peter Dutton has also been proposing that we're going to change the citizenship test so that you have to say that you love Jews. Apparently, not being an anti-Semite is a core constitutive Australian value or something. And I think the citizenship test is silly anyway. Like, you can just, of course, they can figure out what boxes to tick to pass it. It doesn't mean anything. It's really contrived, but it's still crazy. But not even saying it, we got to protect Jews, but not Australians, not Anglo-Saxons, not the people who built this country, not actual Australians. But you've got to make sure that you're cool with the Jews. You can hate Australians. You just got to love Jews if you want to be an Australian for some reason. I mean, how more sycophantic could they get? It's like the Labor Party is already like completely sycophantic towards the Jews. And then the Liberal Party is basically running for this election on the platform of Labor doesn't sycophantically serve the Jews enough. We will bow down and worship our Jewish overlords unlike they've ever been worshipped before in Australian political history. And this is 0.4% of the population. So this is a lot of voters, right? They're really worried about getting that Jewish vote. It's going to really swing the election, right? This is what, in democracy, that's how, no.
Well, sometimes
it's obviously money and power.
Yeah, more than votes do. But Chris Minns reckons it's in our national interest to not have any rights or freedom to believe or what we want to believe, express ourselves the way we want to, in order to preserve and protect multiculturalism. That's the new national interest, according to the New South Wales State Premier.
And like, why does Israel care what Australia thinks? Like, about, like, does it really fucking matter if we support them genociding Gazans or not? Like, who the fuck cares what we think? Why are they so obsessed with?
Maybe they're storing all the gold down here. Maybe in Central Australia, that's why it's sectioned off military. US military property in Central Australia, there's all these like secret vaults, and that's where the Jews keep all the gold.
Well, Australia had some of the largest gold reserves in the world. That's why.
And no one knows where they. No one knows where they are now.
Yeah, the gold. We don't know. Yeah, we don't have any gold anymore. I don't know where it all went. Now we just have to pay 3 million shekels to buy a shitty house in a part of Sydney, so we can have a bunch of Asian and Indian neighbors, and pay a Zog mortgage for the rest of our lives while we that's what it means to be in the lucky country. No one ever says it, the lucky country anymore. You know why? Because I don't feel too fucking lucky anymore. I don't think anyone's feeling that lucky.
Sydney, Australia is what is the most expensive, like economically in terms of real estate, cost of housing. It's the most expensive city in the world. In the world, number one. I can confirm that because I watched a Joe Rogan podcast recently and they were talking about Canada. There was someone on from Canada. I think it was Derek. Nope. Was he from? Derek from More Plates, More Dates. And he's Canadian, I think. So they were talking about how the living standard in Canada is terrible and everything's really expensive. And then they brought up like the top five most expensive cities in the world to live. Toronto was like third. But then Joe Rogan paused. He was like, Sydney, Australia is number one? What the fuck? I didn't know that. How is that possible? I thought Australia was doing okay. So it's like everyone around the world thinks of Australia as this like, you know, prosperous, lucky country still, I suppose. People don't know how bad it's gotten down here. We're even worse than Canada in some states.
Yeah. But anyway, I guess, you know, obviously there's this context of, you know, Jewish subversion and this context of the battle for free speech and so on. But we discussed a little bit before, like earlier today when we talked on the phone, like it would be interesting to take a step back, have a bit more of an abstract discussion about the Jews, right? Because there's like all these concrete examples of, you know, the Jewish lobby pushing for this and pushing for that and their political influence and their overrepresentation in positions of power and wealth and so on. But what is it all about, like fundamentally? Like that's perhaps probably a more interesting question and an important question to discuss, right? Why is this the situation? Because there's a common refrain from people. They'll say like, oh, you know, you're just jealous because Jews are just so much smarter and better at business. That's why they're so successful. And you're just jealous that they're successful. And people will say things like, the Jews deserve to rule over us because they actually take care of they're actually loyal to each other and work together to pursue their interests. And
yeah, they're racist. The Jews are racist. Loyal. They're not successful because they're rich. Like they're not successful because they're smarter and they're not successful because they have money. These things are downstream from the fact that they're more racist. They're more racist than us. That's why they're good at what they do. That's why they've got a strong survival instinct. That's why they stick together. That's why they don't like us. And they, you know, work against us as a unit. They're more racist. It's like racism is actually the answer to basic community preservation. Imagine that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to talk about all of these questions. And I think I was talking to you a bit about the difference between Nietzsche's views on this subject and Martin Heidegger's views on this subject. And these are two very important philosophers, two very famous philosophers. Obviously, Nietzsche's very famous. Martin Heidegger isn't as famous, but he's one of, if not the most famous philosophers of the 20th century, and obviously kind of infamous according to many because Martin Heidegger actually became a fully fledged member of the National Socialist Party in Germany, and he was a supporter of National Socialism. His philosophy is so interesting that it still gets discussed and talked about in philosophy departments around the world despite this. It was too interesting to cancel. And there was a lot of debate, you know, after the war that maybe Heidegger wasn't as extreme in his Nazism as people thought. And, you know, there was all of his cope, basically. But after he died, his notebooks were published, his private notebooks. And his private notebooks are really anti-Semitic, basically. So it shows that, no, he actually has very strong views and it all fits together with his overarching philosophy as to why he was anti-Semitic and why he would support National Socialism. But obviously Friedrich Nietzsche gets called anti-Semitic because he says many disparaging things about Jews, but then at the same time, he also criticizes anti-Semitism in his works You know, in many respects, opposes a lot of anti-Semitic positions. So there's a lot of it's kind of interesting. So I thought we could maybe go through those two perspectives and then discuss it a little bit, like we discussed earlier, because those two perspectives I think correlate a lot to discussions today. Because you can talk about, you know, Jewish power and influence, but you know, discussions of the Jews are about more than just that they have power and influence. Because if a group has power and influence, Is it necessarily a bad thing just because they have power and influence? Like, we want to have power and influence. Is having power and influence inherently bad? Well, no. The question is, why is it dangerous, or why is it a problem, or why is it what is it a symptom of that Jews have such power and influence, and why are we so particularly concerned about it? And, you know, I think what's interesting is that for Heidegger says that, basically, to paraphrase, and it's a lot more abstract and nuanced than I can paraphrase in the kind of purview of this discussion, that the reason why Jews became so powerful and influential in Britain, in America in particular, but in the West in general, is because in the modern world, the West embraced a very scientific, rational, materialistic worldview, which basically converted the world, particularly, and all of our political values, into economic, rational, technical calculations. Whereas in more, you know, pre-modern and particularly ancient times, we were connected to folkways and to religious traditions and mythologies, which resisted this kind of like modern hyper-technical way of approaching the world. And that created a series of values and a way of life that was more impervious to Jewish proclivities. And so what he says is that what defines Jews, and obviously he's writing before Zionism, but that's a kind of a separate thing, or not before Zionism, but before the State of Israel was created. He says basically what defines Jews in European society is that Jews are a homeless people. Jews don't have their own country. And they haven't had their own country since, at least since the defeat of Judea by the Romans back in like 70 AD. So for basically 2,000 years, they've been homeless. And they've been kind of the pariahs of Europe, basically, this entire time. Meanwhile, through the medieval period in Europe, obviously, Europeans, pretty much everyone was a peasant. And so they're connected to the land. They're connected to an organic way of life. They're born and raised into the same life that their father had and their grandfather had and their great-grandfather had and so on. Or maybe they were an aristocrat and it was the same thing. They inherited through their blood a particular set of values and traditions, and they inherited particular lands. And so we were very connected to the soil in particular parts of Europe, and we developed these very specific ways of life. People didn't have an ideology. Most people weren't even literate. They couldn't even read or write. They just had an organic way of life that they were born into and lived within. And obviously we lived off the land, like we farmed the land, and then taxes were paid to the aristocracy, who then defended those lands from external threats. And so it was a kind of a cohesive way of life. But Jews, they weren't peasants. They weren't aristocrats. They didn't live off the land or defend the land. They were homeless. Jews optimized into basically two main means of existence. One means was mercantile, in other words, buying and selling. And the other means is kind of legalistic, because the Jewish religion is a very legalistic religion, and it's all these like debates between different, you know, lawyers, basically. It's even the Talmud, you've got like basically the Jewish lawyers go and debate with God about how to find basically get loopholes in their own laws and stuff. And they even win one of these debates, which makes no sense. But so Jews are very good lawyers. They're very good manipulators of ideas. They're very good at creating these ideologies. They're very good and they're very good at buying and selling. They're good at finance. They're good at business. They're good at negotiation. They're good liars. They're good schemers. They're good manipulators, because they're parasites, essentially. They're homeless. They don't live off the land. They don't live in an organic relation to the earth. They have to therefore manipulate the host society and extract wealth and extract influence and extract power from it. And they've had to live like that for thousands of years. So they've become selected for those kinds of attitudes and ways of being and so on. And then the West started developing all these new technologies and started adopting a more scientific worldview. The economy became industrialized. And, you know, I've talked before on the show about Werner Sombart's Jews and Modern Capitalism and how capitalism and, like, you know, many of its forms are actually quite Jewish in origin in European history, that Jewish merchants innovated and Jewish bankers and traders and so on innovated a lot of the forms of capitalism, which actually violated, you know, medieval norms in Europe, where people kind of looked upon profiteering and competition as something that was immoral, and they didn't engage in it. That's been broken down, and now we live in a very commercialized society. In a certain sense, we live in a very Jewish society. But basically what Heidegger was saying is that as the Western world became more technological, as it became more secular, as it became more modern, it became more and more amenable to Jewish skills, because now being a merchant, being a lawyer, that's how you get power in contemporary society. So then it's perfect for these Jewish skills. And that basically the process of developing all these modern ideologies kind of makes us all homeless. Like, we're all homeless now. No one has a home. No one is really connected to the earth in the way that they used to be. And everything is kind of abstract. You know, the way that we understand, what does it mean to be an Australian? It doesn't mean blood. It doesn't mean connection to soil, unless maybe you're an Aboriginal or something. All it means to be an Australian is these shared values. What are those values? Well, they're abstract notions of equality and human rights or whatever. Things that are basically universal to all of humanity. Like, there's nothing particularly Australian about being Australian, apparently, according to the powers that be. And the same is true for every Western country, this kind of ideology. And so, this kind of liberal modernism makes everyone homeless, and therefore the Jews are optimized for homelessness, and they dominate a universally homeless society, basically, to put it in a certain way. And so Heidegger says that, what we need to do
with that, therefore, indicate that this collective homelessness, as you describe it, would that be an advantage in worldly affairs?
Well, under the current paradigm, it's an advantage for Jews, and that's why Jews are very successful, you could say. And what? So then we could bring in Nietzsche here, because Nietzsche basically is saying is that he thinks that Jews are, you know, fundamentally a racially impure race, and that they have had certain weaknesses historically, and that they created Christianity for, this is Nietzsche's view, not necessarily my view. They created Christianity as a weapon against Aryan society, as a way to upend Aryan society, impose egalitarian morals, and basically cuck European society into becoming weak, because you know, they were basically aggrieved by the domination of particularly Greco-Roman civilization. And so they created Christianity, whether consciously or kind of subconsciously, as a kind of spiritual weapon to undermine and undercut the kind of noble Aryan, who for Nietzsche was so...
I would cut in there and say that it's not really in the nature of the Jewish people, as far as I understand, to create anything. They latch themselves onto what has developed as a result of the creativity of others, or has just kind of organically formed through various other means. And they try to bend, twist, manipulate whatever that is to their advantage. So I think it would be a long shot to say the Jews created Christianity, but they've definitely had some sort of influence over it over time. That much is clear.
Yeah, I don't agree with this genealogy of Nietzsche's. I don't think it's historically accurate. I do think that it's more of a hijack than a creation, myself as well. So I agree with your sentiments there. But this is Nietzsche's narrative anyway. So he says a lot of things which are anti-Semitic in his, like, anti-Christian rants, right? Because he basically says that, like, the weakness of the Jewish spirit and the fact that the Jews had this overdeveloped intellect but underdeveloped physical health meant that they were resentful towards their physical superiors, who had so much more vitality and strength and therefore dominated them. And so they created a worldview that glorified the weak and kind of tried to drag the strong down to their level, basically. And that became a conduit. Well, the conduit for that was Christianity to unleash upon the world. But now Nietzsche says that it's kind of broken free of Christianity, and now it exists as things like socialism and leftism, that these have a fundamentally, you know, Jewish priestly origin, but they've infected European society at large. And so what Nietzsche, the reason why Nietzsche opposed the anti-Semites was because he thought that Christianity and socialism and so on was a disease in Europeans, and that it wasn't really about Jews pulling the strings, bringing everything down, but now Europeans had basically become spiritual Jews themselves and were destroying their own civilization, that like they'd been so infected with these viruses that it wasn't even really the Jews doing it anymore for Nietzsche, and that a lot of Jews for Nietzsche actually were quite intelligent and had a lot of great skills. And so Nietzsche didn't think that they were, you know, they were being scapegoated basically for a lot of these processes as a way to, you know, basically project the crises of Europe onto them rather than take responsibility for the fact that we have become infected with all of these egalitarian ideologies. And because obviously Nietzsche didn't like Christians or Christianity. He thought it was kind of cope, the Christian cope that like, and also you could see this parallel, I guess, in some movements today where, or some commentators today where, you know, they'll talk about this notion of Jewish supremacy. And I've criticized this, that like, oh, like we need to defeat Jewish supremacy. And it's like, well, obviously I don't want Jews to be supreme, but the connotation is that the problem with Jewish supremacy is the supremacy rather than that it's Jewish. I want white supremacy. I want to be supreme. But they almost seem to be criticizing the very idea of supremacy. Like the problem with Jews is that they only care about themselves and that they think that they're better than everyone else. Well, I only care about white people and I think we're better than everyone else, actually. Like I don't have a problem with Jews thinking that. I have a problem with whites not thinking that, actually. And if we thought it like they did, we would beat them. So the issue isn't so much supremacy as it is that we lack it and they have it in spirit and in fact, as a result. And that would be kind of like a Nietzschean critique of a kind of an egalitarian anti-Semitism. And I kind of agree with that. But this more basic premise of Nietzsche is that, you know, oh, well, for Nietzsche, the solution to the Jewish question was just basically just breed them with whites. That like and Nietzsche also didn't like nationalism. He thought, I'm a European, not a German. That's what Nietzsche's view was. And that that basically the best blood of Europe, all the great intellectuals, all the great artists, all the great politicians, etc., they should all just breed together and create a new European aristocracy and rule over this great new European empire that is built around strength.
That's kind of what's happened organically anyway, isn't it?
Well, no, because, I mean, we live in an egalitarian order. Like Nietzsche's ideal was to throw off the shackles.
But if you look at who's ruling society, it's like a combination of white and Jewish autists.
Yeah, yeah. So there has been a fusion of our ruling class and the Jewish ruling class, but I would say that it's not really our aristocracy. I don't think people like Keir Starmer or Anthony Albanese or Peter Dutton.
I was thinking more of like the Elon Musks, you know, and sort of tech giants, people who are like really into, you know, working hard and moving the development of technology forward.
Yes. Elon Musk is a great example.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great
Wouldn't hold people like Keir Starmer and Peter Dutton as like examples of a, you know, genetic or even social aristocracy. They're not really aristocrats in my mind in any sense. Like I said, I was thinking more of people like Elon Musk.
Yeah, well, Elon Musk is a great example, and that kind of typifies this Nietzschean view of where Heidegger was kind of skeptical of the technological, not that like technology is bad, but the reduction of everything to a kind of scientific, rational worldview and completely like cutting ourselves off from anything mystical or primordial or traditional or really authentically spiritual. Nietzsche didn't really care about that aspect so much and was kind of like, well, like strength and vitality is all that matters. And so if we can breed the top Europeans with the top Jews and create this, you know, technological empire that can dominate the world, so be it, right? He didn't really Nietzsche was racist. He was a racialist. He thought he was a white supremacist, but he also, you know, thought that Jews could be considered part of the broader, broadly speaking, European race and bred into it. Someone like Heidegger or many like National Socialists would be like horrified by that idea because for them, the Jews were you know, they basically had the spiritual disease that they were trying to extricate out of the European race, which was this the development of kind of this economic, scientific, rationalist thinking that had kind of cut people off from like honoring the race, honoring the blood. And there was a certain mystical quality to National Socialism. So this is an interesting distinction, because it's almost like if you really want to be, if you're just a biological reductionist and you're a scientific reductionist, like Elon Musk seems to be, for example, and you just think about everything in terms of technology and science, then there really isn't much of a reason to be an anti-Semite. The logical thing would be we should just mix Jews and whites together and rule the world together rather than fight each other. Whereas if you're more spiritually minded, like this is my position, I sided with Heidegger in this debate, then you would view that as horrifying. You would view it as basically, well, that would mean like we would just become Jews and this would be horrible. Like, yeah, maybe it would work, but it would be horrible because in the sense that it would work in a vulgar sense, but it'd be horrible because it would completely cut us off from who we are as a race. That would be horrific. Then there's no coming back from that. We would become forever homeless in this kind of techno prison. And so I don't know. I think this is
exactly like we're living in like a post-industrialized world, and the development of technology is, this is obviously an important factor to consider in this idea that you're explaining here. As we touched on earlier in the stream, largely the cause for the advent of democracy was the development of certain weapons. You can say even that technology went in a certain direction which allowed democracy to exist or become a mainstream thing. The concept of it, at least, like in practice, we don't get much of a democracy. That's, you know, but that's besides the point. The point is that because we live in this era of technology, it allows that Nietzschean perspective that you've explained to kind of manifest itself. And even it's happening organically, like sort of intellectual whites are, you know, mixing with intellectual Jews, and that seems to be the sort of masterclass of the world to some extent, but only because of the technological state that the world has reached. And as long as technology keeps advancing, is this situation going to get worse? And is our old way of connection to the land, connection to the ancestors, whatever it is that we came out of, whatever is natural to us, is that going to be of any use in the future as technology continues to develop? Or is that all just sort of a superseded weakness?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think technology destroys, in many sense, like technological society is weakening the blood. And that doesn't mean that I oppose technology, but that we have to take that into consideration, that like basically go and walk around inner city Melbourne and you see like cosmopolitan types, they're all sickly. They're all skinny. They're all weak. They're eating shit. They look like shit. They're genetically and physically just defective. And therefore their values, their politics is also defective. They're all leftists, or a lot of them are leftists, because their valuation of, and this is, you know, Nietzsche's philosophy determined or would determine this, like their, the outward manifestation of what they believe or their inner life is determined by, in many respects, by the kind of physical health and vitality in the body. So we should be using technology to maximize the physical vitality of the body so that the mind, the psyche becomes healthy. And if the psyche is healthy, then it will come to more noble and honorable conclusions about politics and about morality and so on. And we can live in a more noble and honorable society which accentuates the best aspects of humanity and tries to cut off the weaker aspects of humanity. Where at the moment, what is happening is that we're getting weakened by technology, basically, because we have this kind of egalitarian parasitism and all of these weak people attaching themselves to these like techno hives, which are the major cities, and adopting this.
Isn't it, Joel? It's curious that people like Elon Musk, who are apparently obsessed with developing the best rockets and finding the smartest and most capable people to develop even better rockets and AI technology and so forth, where all that comes from, all the development of this technology, it arguably comes from the quality of the race, the quality of the genetic structure of humanity as a whole, or even a specific substrata of humanity, because all that we choose to sum up under the phrase humanity, I think it's ridiculous. I don't like the term humanity. But you'd think Elon Musk would be more concerned with contributing to an advancement of the species in order to guarantee that technology can develop in a way that's going to both complement the development of the species and also, you know, push us out into the stars. But instead, he doesn't seem to be concerned with, you know, genetics or development of human races at all. He's like just obsessed with these rockets and AI technology. But like we as a society, right? No one has anything against breeding strong racehorses, and everyone would agree that a great deal of money and effort goes into breeding the strongest horses possible. And we can all agree that the genetically stronger racehorses are beautiful and they run faster and they're just better in every way that matters. But the moment someone starts to talk about breeding a higher humanity, well, that's offensive. We can't talk about that. Why not? You know, I think it'd be interesting if people like Elon could develop more of an interest in actually advancing the race rather than just building better rockets.
Well, I think Elon Musk has a somewhat eugenic worldview, actually, and there's evidence of that looking at his Twitter activity. But his conception is equivalent to what used to get called IQ nationalism but in some circles. And it was very popular in neo-reactionary blogosphere back in the day. I used to follow developments in where some people would say, oh, well, you know, Asians and Jews and certain high caste types from some other races, they have high IQs. And so if immigration only lets those types into white countries and they get bred in, well, the IQ will stay high, and so we'll still have people that can be technical professionals in high IQ professions, and people with higher IQs commit less crimes and have more pro-social behaviors and have more to contribute to technology and other domains of human activity. The real problem is these blacks and other races that have low IQs. If you bring them in, all they do is extract resources from the state because they're not productive members of society. They're not intelligent enough to contribute to society. They contribute to crime and the degradation of, you know, basically they leech off the welfare state and so on. So we should, you know, but it's basically, it's a coat for guys with Asian misses, right? Well, but not, you know, Asians have high IQs, Jews have high IQs. So basically we should basically fuse with them into the high IQ peoples of the world and just remove all the lower elements. And I think Elon Musk has a worldview like this, where he thinks in those terms. Get rid of the Muslims and the blacks and rid of the browns and the blacks, but we'll have the high caste Indians that can do software development, and we'll have the Asians and we'll have the Jews. And they're all like, that's his future. They can all build the technology. And because from like a rational standpoint, it's like if you reduce everything to like IQ statistics or something, you can develop that kind of view. I think you have to have a more spiritual, a more nuanced, a more cultural worldview to understand the value specifically of European man. That European man isn't just valuable because we have high IQs and we're good at building technology. That just views us as like an instrument for the technological system or for the economic system. That's kind of disgusting that there's the beauty of what we've achieved with our race and in our civilization actually goes far beyond that, and preserving that is actually what we're engaged in here, and that has inherent value, and that's something that, you know, basically there isn't a politics trying to do that. I think the National Socialists in Germany were trying to do that, but there isn't a politics trying to do that anymore, really, in any serious way. And that's my politics. Like that's what I'm trying to do. That's why I differentiate. So these arguments about, well, you know, what's the problem with Jews? It's like, Jews, I think, are spiritually defective. I don't think, because Jews have these, like, as Heidegger said, these homeless people who are optimized for basically lying, manipulating, whether it be economic manipulation or whether it be political manipulation through ideology or through legal wrangling or whatever, they destroy a society that is built upon immutable principles like honor. They destroy the virtue of society. And that those virtues might not be able to be defended within the prism of what's good for the economy or what enables technological development to proceed or something, but they don't have to be. They have value that exists, that can be understood within a different framework, which these, you know, hyper-rationalist, reductive materialist frameworks can't understand. But the problem is that those frameworks themselves are spiritually vapid, and I think this is why, ultimately, what is happening to us isn't because of the Jews. What is happening to us is because of us. It's because white people, particularly Anglo societies, adopted these liberal individualist scientistic worldviews, I should say, because I think science is great, but scientistic in the sense of relativizing everything to science, eliminating everything which science can't explain. People who have developed these worldviews have become, and so many people in our race have developed this way of approaching the world in terms of how can I make money? How can I gain comfort?
That's what the world encourages you to do.
And, yeah, exactly. That's why we're in this position.
The problem is when everyone thinks that way, you're kind of forced to do the same thing in order to compete with everybody else. And Hitler writes about this in a small segment in Mein Kampf. He makes a distinction between intelligence exclusively and intelligence that's wedded with what he calls idealism, or what is translated to idealism in the Ralph Mannheim translation that I read. Problem with Mein Kampf is it is translated from German, so you're not sure how accurately the words are translated into English sometimes. Plus, English is a different language, so it doesn't always make perfect sense. But it's described by the translator as idealism. And what Hitler means, I think, when he's writing about the distinction between intelligence exclusively and intelligent idealism is intelligence on its own is only destructive. Because if you're smart, but you don't have any sort of meaningful or higher ideals such as honor, fairness, justice, then you intelligence to leverage a society to your advantage, to exploit, to take advantage of, because that's all intelligence exclusively will end up encouraging you to do. But if it's wedded with the certain ideals that are native to our kind, such as honor, then intelligence can end up being used in the service of the advancement of the species rather than just in the service of yourself.
Yeah, that's well said. And I think you're getting at it. It's like one of our slogans, and this is an NS slogan, is blood and honor. And you know, recently, you know, I found it funny that, you know, I was getting told by Nick Fuentes that, oh, you know, this like National Socialist swastika stuff, you know, this is bad politics. It's going to alienate people, you know. We need to be more pragmatic. We need to have a new way of approaching politics. And, you know, but then when a billionaire nigger rapper decides he wants to call himself a national socialist and wear swastika necklaces and all the rest of it, apparently this is the greatest thing ever. And
well, because it was different though, because he can't be written off by the institutions and the ruling class as, you know, a neo-Nazi or a racist necessarily, because the guy's black. So there's certain nuance to understand.
Perhaps,
there.
But if he was a black guy that wasn't famous and had no money, then he would all, like he wouldn't be considered relevant. What's relevant is that is money and fame in the calculation.
Would this mean? And I'm just spitballing here, that to Nick Fuentes, relevance is more important than philosophical purity.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that, like, my principles are blood and honor. And I think if we're going to save the race, part of saving the race is not just the practicality of how to attain political power. It's also a spiritual transformation of the race back into these virtuous principles of loyalty and honor that are ancient, that are the principles of the old European aristocracy. That have been lost. What has happened to the white race is that a very large portion of us have become spiritually Jewish, basically. And insofar as we're spiritually Jewish, it doesn't even really matter if we defeat the Jews, because if we defeat the Jews, but fundamentally we have the same spiritual orientation to the world as them, and we're just chasing after money and fame, if we're just chasing after personal advantage, if everything is reduced to economic benefit, if everything is reduced to getting mine, then what's the point of winning? Like, you know, if we have non-Jews but that are Marxist running society, or that are like Marxist materialists, or if we have non-Jewish, you know, capitalists running society, it's still going to be a shit society. It's still going to be fundamentally fucked. It's not going to be a society worth living in. It's not going to be a society that is going to express what is actually valuable about the white race. What we need is an honorable and noble people to become sovereign. And then we can have an honorable and noble way of life as a people. And that is really what's worth saving about the white race, is that honor and nobility, those qualities in our people. And those are the qualities that, if we're going to defeat the Jews, in my opinion, we're actually going to need to embrace. I don't think we can actually beat the Jews in our own game.
The qualities like honor, fairness, justice, etc. Do you think in a world like ours, material world, where victory often goes to the most relentless and the most persevering, do you think these qualities can be a weakness? And maybe that's why we're in the position that we're in now. Do you think perhaps becoming rootlessly cosmopolitan, as the Jewish people have become, is actually the way to global victory? That being too tied down by virtues and ideals is the reason that we're in a position right now where we don't have power over our own fate as a people. What do you think about that perspective?
But we are of a fundamentally different orientation towards the world. So, like, in order, the Jews fundamentally have a parasitical relationship to our civilization and a destructive relationship to our civilization. They didn't go and create their own independent form of civilization that expresses all of their values and so on. Instead, they have attached themselves like leeches to our civilization and siphon off all of these resources and benefits from what we created, and largely what was created before we were born. It was this incredible historical legacy that we've inherited, and we're largely living off that inheritance. Like,
what I'm asking you is, if this were the case, I'm not saying this dynamic of choice exists, but if it did, would it be better to survive as a race of parasites rather than die as a race or a great noble beast? I mean, what's more important, surviving?
Well, I think becoming parasites would mean that we would die. Like, that would, the essence of who we
only
are.
Only after the death of your victim, right? So you need to live off something else, which is probably why I don't think the powers that be in the world today would ever let white people die off entirely. I think they need other races, including ours, in order to sustain themselves. And I think they're going to realize that if they haven't already. But it's not as simple as I put it, or as I tried to articulate it just now, meaning that dynamic doesn't necessarily exist. But if it did, do you have to adapt yourself to circumstances and sometimes become a little bit like your enemy in order to survive? Or can you just stubbornly double down on the old ways and hope that that gets you through? What's the most intelligent choice in that situation?
Well, that's the thing. I think if we embrace loyalty and honor in a radical way as a race, we will win. That will make us
strong. It's a good perspective. Arguably, there's great efforts made to try to prevent us from being loyal to each other.
Exactly. The reason why we're losing is because each other.
It's like they fear collective loyalty on our part. If we're going to become ethnically loyal to our own people and do whatever it takes to advance our own interests, including, you know, removing foreigners from our country and overturning current systems of government which are detrimental to our survival as a species, as a race, well, you know, obviously that's not going to be good for people who are existing as parasites latched onto our race. So I can see what you're saying there. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. I think these values of blood and honor are the values that are the path to victory. And what is victory? Victory, as I understand it as a nationalist, is self-determination, having the ability for white people to determine and for individual white nations and white people as a race to determine our own path. In other words, to create civilizations and societies based upon our own willpower, based upon our own values, that are so powerful and are so robust that they're impervious to foreign influence. They're impervious to outside manipulation. That should be the objective, where we are in charge of our own destiny as a people and we can live according to our own rules. So number one is, what are our own rules? And I think our own rules are fundamentally this notion of honor and loyalty. In other words, what is worth preserving about an Aryan existence or a white existence if we just become subsumed into this, you know, global economic techno-capitalist machine? Well, what difference does it make if it's white individualists, what difference does it make if the prostitutes are white instead of brown? What difference does it make if the bankers are white instead of Jewish? What difference does it make? It doesn't actually make any fucking difference. Like, fundamentally, it will be the same mode of existence. And also, it'll be according to a logic that doesn't really differentiate whites from non-whites. In order to really differentiate us from non-whites, you need to have a higher conception of who we are. Otherwise, basically, we're just another type of human mass. Like, there's nothing really worth preserving. So we actually need to have a cultural and spiritual self-consciousness. And also, it's going to be a struggle. We're going to have to take on the people who rule the world and the current ruling paradigms of the world. That's going to be difficult. It's going to require sacrifice. It's going to require bloodshed. It's going to require struggle. And no one wants to do any of those things unless they're motivated by the principles of blood and honor. If they're just motivated by material self-interest, then they would want to avoid those things. And they do. That's called being a conservative, right? Okay. So, like, there's literally no path to victory except actually embracing these values. And these values are the essence of who we are. That is what victory is, living according to our own values. So, you know, if... obviously, if people are influential and have resources and they want to support the movement, that's good. But if the movement is just being, if the movement is actually a movement, it has, that means that they're subordinating their money and resources to these higher principles of blood, loyalty, and honor. If money and fame become kind of ends in themselves, then you actually lose the whole thing, and it just becomes like an entertainment product. It just becomes another aspect of kind of global America, where everything is, as I said, an entertainment product. It's not really politics. It's not really struggle. It's not really risk taking. It's just spectacle.
Plenty of that spectacle and a money going on. I've actually noticed some. There's like a trend on X right now where girls just like post themselves saying like white nationalist stuff, and all these, you know, they develop small armies of simps that are like, oh my god, this girl's amazing, look at this guy's, then she's like, yeah, buy my t-shirts. It's pathetic, man, but that in essence is like part of the problem and part of what you're talking about, I suppose. But we've had societies or civilizations that were impervious to outside influence or subversion before. We've had, you know, people who were very ethnically conscious. They were aware of how important their race was and how important it was to preserve and protect it. The problem is that understanding, that perspective, was never multi-generational. And we've developed so quickly in terms of like technology, and culture has experienced such dramatic shifts so quickly over, you know, span of just a few generations, that we've forgotten what's important very easily, haven't we? So we need a solution that's going to be multi-generational, something we can easily pass down regardless of changing culture or circumstances.
Yeah, it was just brought to my attention. People might know who Led the Apron Club is. He's an American YouTuber, and he has a bunch of YouTube videos talking about Jewish overrepresentation, among other subjects. And I've actually collaborated with him a few times before, and I've spoke to him as well in private. I haven't spoken to him recently, but he's a good guy and he does good work. And he's got an interesting YouTube project, but he just launched a new project, socialsentinel.net. And it's basically a website where you can type in individuals or organizations and it'll tell you their ethnic background, basically. So it's just like a good database for checking if people are Jewish or not, more or less. But he's been working on this for a long time. He's been talking about this for a long time.
It's normally obvious if someone is Jewish, in my experience. However, there is the occasion where I'm surprised to discover that someone has like Jewish background. So it's not always obvious, but, you know, to me it usually is. But I'm pretty distinctly not Jewish, so it's easy to spot people with their set of characteristics for me personally. What about you, Joel? Can you like identify Jews pretty easily, or have you ever been surprised before?
Oh, I've been surprised before, because particularly when, you know, they're mixed, you know, sometimes it can be hard, but I think I got a pretty good Judah, better than most, pretty perceptive on these things. But, you know
what's funny is I was like,
you couldn't have a database, and Wikipedia is less and less reliable. Like, there's the old reliable of checking the Wikipedia early life section, but it's not always clear from that for a lot of people. So a database run by our guys that are objectively trying to put together good data on the subject is a useful resource. So socialsentinel.net, obviously it's in the alpha stage. It's just been launched like literally today. I'll post the video. I haven't even watched his video where he describes it on YouTube yet because we've been doing the stream, but I'll post it on Telegram and I'll watch the video, and I think we should support the project. And obviously over time, if it gets developed, it could be a very useful resource for checking who's Jewish. And there's probably ways in which you can help contribute to it. I don't know exactly. I have to watch the video, but anyway, go check it out. Leather Apron Club on YouTube is his YouTube, and socialsentinel.net. Just wanted to give it a shout out because it's a project from someone who I support. So
that's cool. But on the subject of recognizing Jewish characters, you will notice if you pay special attention that some effort is put in by individuals of the Jewish community to try not to be recognized as Jews and to try not to be really recognized at all. And I was shouted down during a family dinner once, not by members of my own family, but by another family, because they weren't really happy with me trying to make this point. But do you remember the movie with Al Pacino, The Devil's Advocate, and Keanu Reeves was in that film too? Remember that?
I don't think I've seen it actually. Devil's Advocate.
Quite cool. It's like Al Pacino literally plays the devil, but you know, even though there's certain hints.
Isn't he like a lawyer? That's when he's like, you can't handle the truth. Oh no, that's Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's a different.
But there's a really interesting, several interesting scenes and speeches where, and the one I'm going to refer to is where Al Pacino is walking with Keanu Reeves through the streets of New York City. And Keanu Reeves is a tall, attractive, clean-cut, impressive man. And Al Pacino makes the point. Al Pacino, let's not forget, is actually playing the devil, Satan. He makes the point that Keanu Reeves in the movie, the character he's playing, he's got everything going for him. But his problem is that people know what to expect from him. They expect a fair bit from him. Like, he's got a reputation and he looks good and he stands out. He makes the point that you've got to be the little guy if you really want to win. You have to be unassuming. You have to fly under the radar. People can't see you coming. They can't expect much from you. And that's the point he's trying to make, what his colleague needs to learn in order to really start generating power in the city for himself. And I thought, isn't that peculiar? Because that, in my experience, is literally what the Jewish characters I've met and dealt with do. I remember working for a construction company when I was a bit younger, and we built this high-rise apartment complex for a father and son who were Jewish. And they used to come onto the job site on occasion just to, you know, make their presence felt and see how the work was going. They weren't like particularly rude or difficult to deal with, actually likable people mostly. But I found it peculiar that they were clearly so wealthy. They were building a 36-story apartment complex, just them. They were paying for it all. This is like, you know, several hundred million dollars put into this place. And there's only several building companies you can use in Melbourne that are able to build a facility like that. But these guys were wearing like trackies from Kmart and driving Ford Lasers, cars that are worth like $2-3. They looked homeless. They were unkempt. They didn't even shave or cut their hair or anything. They didn't wear jewelry. You would never know they were as wealthy as they were. And I can't help but think of that scene from The Devil's Advocate where Al Pacino is clearly making a point of the fact that you can't seem very impressive if you're really going to win. You can't develop a reputation where people have a high expectation of you. You have to seem unimpressive and you have to fly under the radar. No one can see you coming is the way he puts it. And it just made me think of all the interactions I've had with very wealthy Jewish people in the past. It's almost like the devil's playbook is the one they use. And there's certain, I started off by saying I was shouted down at a family dinner for trying to make this point, because the way I tried to tie the point together was that perhaps the God that the Jews worship might be the devil, might be Satan, right? And I used to actually think that for a while. And I know that some people still think that, but there's been various other, you know, views and perspectives that have come across that have kind of like made me think a little bit differently and about what the devil could be or whether there's a devil at all, stuff like that. Maybe that's what he wants me to think. I don't know. But I just thought it was peculiar that parallel with Al Pacino and the way members of the Jewish community who are particularly wealthy actually behave. It's like they follow that exact playbook.
Well, I guess, I mean, and that's the total opposite, I think, of the Aryan strategy. The Aryan strategy is, I remember you telling me, and this is what you say often as well, when you talk about Mein Kampf, when you read Mein Kampf, and you said, what appealed to you so much when you read that book, to paraphrase you, was that here's a guy who wrote a book saying, this is what I'm going to do. We're going to do this, 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 and this, and this is why. Support us. Put the book out to the Germans when he had no power, became the number one bestseller in Germany. The country read it, became aware of what his program was, ended up supporting his rise to power. He takes power and basically does more or less everything that he said he was going to do in his book. And you were like, what kind of fucking politician does that? What kind of politician actually means what they say? What kind of politician is sincere? What kind of politician is doing it for the actual reasons that they say they're doing?
Most honest revolution in the history of humanity. It's like, this is our problem. This is what propaganda is. You need it because you're simple. I'm going to use it for this purpose and we're going to have a revolution. Then I'm going to be king. I'm going to be the ruler. And everyone's like, okay, let's do it. That's why I chose National Socialism or developed an interest in that when I was young instead of communism, because I correctly identified communism as a trick, whereas National Socialism wasn't a trick. It was just like an overt explanation. Like Hitler's book is a very clear and honest explanation of exactly what he believes and what he's going to do. Whereas you read the Communist Manifesto and you've got some crude propaganda story about the proletariat versus bourgeoisie, and the people who have concocted that story are actually just using that as a tool to aggravate the workers so that they can get power over the existing aristocrats in that region. And so, you know, one was just bullshit and the other was real. That's the way I saw it.
Well, yeah, and that's playing to what I'm articulating here, which is that the way in which we are going to save ourselves as a race is not through some marketing trick, not through some indirect strategy, not through moving through the shadows. We're going to do it in the open, in the light, and we're going to do it on the basis of truth. And I'm not saying this just because I'm an idealist. I am an idealist. But I'm saying it because that's the only actual way in which we can achieve the outcome that we want, which is a society that reflects who we are as a people. And who we are as a people is, we're not bullshitters. We're a sincere people. We're an honorable people. And insofar as we lose that, we lose who we are. And that is the reason why we're in this position. The reason why we're in this position isn't because of the Jews. The Jews are a symptom. The reason we're in this position because we have violated and turned against our own values and principles, and we've abandoned them, and we've adopted principles which facilitate Jewish power. And it's kind of like we made a deal with the devil, kind of like in Faust. We made this Faustian bargain to gain wealth, to gain technological ability or whatever, to develop. Like, look at like the way in which Jews first accumulated power in European history. Basically, the Catholic Church outlawed usury, and you can. I got certain objections against Catholics and against Catholicism, having been a former Catholic, but they were 100% correct to ban usury, and Catholicism did protect Europe in many respects from the development of financial power for centuries because of this. But then, what was discovered was that, well, Jews aren't Catholic, so they aren't subject to these rules, so Jews can land money. And in those days, if you were a king, you know, you didn't have absolute power over your subjects. It was a very decentralized system just because of practicality. Like, the king didn't have enough money and resources to basically establish courts of the king and police forces and standing militaries that answered directly to him across the whole territory. But what happened was that there was a series of like dukes or lords that ran different regions and collected taxes in that region. And they had their own, you know, men that were loyal to them from their clan. And then they were then loyal to the king. So if the king wanted to go to war, he had to get all of his, you know, lords and dukes and all the other aristocrats together and make it worth their while. He had to either they owed him favors or he owed them favors or whatever. And so that was a constraint upon his activity. Like, he couldn't just declare war whenever he felt like it, because if, you know, the aristocracy didn't want to fight and they weren't getting enough out of it, it was going to be difficult for him to do so. But then if a Jew comes along and says, hey, like, do you want to take this loan? then the kings of Europe could get cashed up, basically, and afford to give out more favors, to pay more mercenaries to go and fight their wars. And the kings that were honorable, who didn't use finance, they were only able to work off what their organic favors and enabled them to do. Whereas basically the kings that used Jewish finance were basically juicing. They were basically performance enhancing, you know, drug taking to be able to build bigger armies and then conquer the lands of the more honorable kings. And so the dishonorable conquered the honorable because of these advantages that they got. But all this did was then fill, you know, the Jewish coffers with gold and enable them to build ultimately up enough strength. And obviously a lot of kings, they racked up a huge debt to, you know, the Jewish banks. And then they were like, oh, the damn Jews, like everyone quick run them out of town. So they didn't have to pay their debts back, which is kind of funny. And they were ran up a huge tab with the local Shlomo and then run him out of town, like these fucking scheming Jews. And the people are like, yeah, fuck Jews, and then get rid of them. And you don't have to pay them back. That happened quite a lot of times in European history, but eventually the Jews managed to get in command of enough money and resources that couldn't be done anymore. They started breeding into the aristocracy. They started buying up strategic influence. And then particularly with the development of the printing press, they started buying up media, the development of capitalism. They started, you know, getting involved in all of these international trade markets and financial markets. And then they simply just became too powerful to run out of town. And then it was over, right? So basically, you know, we kind of created this mess with our own dishonor. We enabled this mess to come into existence through all of these historical poor decisions. And unless we take the responsibility on ourselves to go, we need to fix what's wrong with us spiritually and morally first and build a political movement that reflects those better moral and spiritual values, we aren't going to actually throw off this yoke because it's a yoke that we've imposed upon ourselves through our own lack of virtue. That's
why I asked a question earlier, which alluded to the possibility that honesty, ideals like honesty, honor, virtues could be a weakness, but you could summarize all of those virtues as not being a bullshitter, right? I don't think not being a bullshitter, I don't think being honest is a weakness. You just have to remove the bullshitters from your society. You identify and remove bullshit, and so long as you can continue to do that, then not being a bullshitter is not a weakness. It's only a weakness so long as you tolerate bullshitters. The more bullshitters you tolerate in a society that's trying to not bullshit, you know, the faster you're going to decay, I think. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you build a political movement around honor, around loyalty, then that's going to be a genuine idealism. That political movement is going to be able to withstand struggle, sacrifice, and so on, and it's going to be a lot harder to defeat. Right? Because how does the enemy maintain power right now? It maintains power essentially by buying people off, paying people off. Like all of these politicians, do they just love Jews? No, they're getting paid. Like they're trying, or whether it's directly or indirectly, they want to ingratiate themselves with certain cliques of powerful individuals because there's a lot of benefits to being part of the elite clique, obviously. None of these politicians that are making these decisions are poor men. They're all doing very well for themselves. And they don't get paid that much. They have way more money than what they get paid. It's because they're getting paid in other ways.
Historically, there was an American statesman, I can't remember which, who said anyone who gets rich in politics is a traitor. That you shouldn't be able to get rich in politics. And if someone has gotten rich in politics, they're corrupt. That exactly. Should be the rule generally, I think.
Absolutely. And so, you know, and obviously the media, all these journalists that work for mainstream media, they're also all prostitutes. They're getting paid to lie. If they wanted to do sincere journalism, they wouldn't be able to work at Channel 9. They wouldn't be able to work at Sky News. So they're getting paid to manipulate, paid to lie. That's why they lie. Like, so building a society upon you know, basically self-interest, deception, you know, what is going to come of that? You're going to have a government that is fundamentally disloyal to your own people, and you're going to lose sovereignty. You're going to not reach your potential as a people. Whereas if you build a government around honesty, around virtue, that government is going to unlock the full potential of your nation. Your nation will become far stronger. So that's what we need to be building our nation on. That's the only way to unleash the potential of what Australia can be, or what our race can be, in more broadly speaking. We're not going to manipulate our way to victory here. Like, obviously we have to create propaganda, and we have to make pragmatic judgments. We have to deploy new technologies. I'm not saying that we become Puritans that abscond the articles of victory, but it all has to be subordinated to these higher ideals. And if we lose those ideals, we've already lost before we've even begun. And that's basically the essence of what conservatism is. It makes all of these concessions to the point that even if they win an election, well, they've already lost anyway, because they've conceded on principle. So it doesn't matter if you win, because you're already lost.
Yeah, well, we've been, it's been a great chat tonight. We've just passed two hours. We've been streaming for 2 hours. And we've got something in the works, don't we, Joel? We're thinking about doing a different type of show, perhaps next week, just to change things up and give you guys some exclusive content. But we'll, you know, give you a bit more information about that as we come closer to the date.
We might still do a stream. We might just put that out. We haven't really decided, but Blair came up with a cool idea for a project, so we're going to give it a go.
I think it'll be cool. I think definitely for some of the younger guys, I think they'll really enjoy it. We have some super chats, though. You're keen to move on to those? How you feeling?
Yeah, we can do super chats for sure.
Cool. What's the first one? I copied most of them down in the StreamYard chat.
Skeletor 2 said, I recently found that you can't get scissors through Woolworths Click and Collect, nor can you get a Stanley knife delivered through Bunnings. This is where we are at. That's funny.
As I said, the controlled weapons list in Victoria specifically is really extensive, including walking canes and riding crops. There's more stuff on there that's crazy. That's just a couple of the items I recall from having, you know, looked very briefly over the list previously, because I couldn't actually believe the sort of shit I was seeing on there. But it's pretty tight here in Australia. It's pretty tight regarding weapons and guns and stuff like that. I know that we have some pretty strict gun laws, but I'm not really into guns and stuff. It's never been my style, so I don't really know the extent of those. I just know that it's pretty much... when I was a kid, I used to collect knives. I don't know why. I just had this... Joel describes it as some sort of, you know, esoteric Anglo-Saxon genetic predisposition or something, some fascination with knives. Apparently, we love knives. Doesn't the term Anglo-Saxon...
What does that mean to be a Saxon? Well, a Saxon, an Anglo is a fisherman, but the Saxon tribe, it basically means knife fighter.
Right. I didn't know that, but I know that I had a appreciation for knives. I used to collect them as a kid. And the police, while looking for something else, saw some knives in my house and they ended up taking them from me and said, these are being seized under the Controlled Weapons Act. And I ended up being charged with it. And I was like, what? I've been collecting those since I was like 12. I didn't know I wasn't allowed to have them. It's kind of like, it's gotten to the point, well, if you're an Indian, you can have a ceremonial knife and carry it around everywhere. There's exemptions for certain, you know, religions. It just goes to show how ridiculous multiculturalism is. But it's gotten to the point in Australia where there are enough laws for the police to always arrest you for something. And I think that's the point. There's so many laws that you're always technically in breach of the law somehow at any given moment. But whatever it is that you're doing, you're breaking some bureaucratic level of law. So it's like you can be under arrest. Like, that's why when you get pulled over in Australia now, it's frustrating and stressful, because you're wondering, like previously, like 30, 40 years ago, if you're being pulled over by police, you'd probably be pretty confident because you're thinking, well, I know I'm not doing anything wrong. I wasn't speeding. The car's registered. Now, if you get pulled over by police, you're wondering which of the 35 laws you could possibly have been in breach of in the last 5 seconds with a few of the, you know, movements that you made in your vehicle. So yeah, that's the situation here. It's pretty ridiculous, but it is our reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been on the receiving end of the law being weaponized in a clearly malicious way by police many times, obviously as a nationalist. I remember one experience that you just kind of triggered the memory of when I was with Jack Eltis and Gabe as well, who are, you know, two prominent members of the organization, Jack being the New South Wales leader, Gabe, the former Queensland leader. He moved to New South Wales, so now he's in New South Wales. But so, like, you know, two veterans of the org. And I was up visiting Sydney, and we did a training session. And as we start our training session and we started doing the beep test, then all of a sudden two police helicopters start flying over the top, and all these police rock up to this random park and detain us all and cause this big kerfuffle. And we're just literally training in a park. I think I talked about it on the show like the week after, back when it happened last year. It was ridiculous, and it was ultimately a nothing burger, but they were just, they sent Raptor Squad, which is a segment of New South Wales police that's specifically anti-bikie cops that are trained basically to just weaponize the law to antagonize bikies to the point that bikies flip out and do something stupid so they can arrest them and, you know, try and drag them before the courts on like a more elaborate charge. And so they like defect your car with all these ridiculous defect notices and get you on all these stupid legal technicalities and so on and just mess with you, right? And so anyway, we were driving, we left, and we were driving after, you know, we dealt with the police, and we're just like, look, we're just going to leave, you know, fuck this noise. And obviously they were all following us everywhere. We get pulled over after we arrive. I think we're going to the pub. And as we get there, we get pulled over by these cops, and the cops come up to Jack basically and say, oh, like, you didn't indicate left as you were exiting the roundabout, you know, four times. So that's four infringements. And like, that's like over $1,000 in fines and like all your demerit points gone. And it's like, no one indicates left going out of roundabouts. Like, literally no one ever does that. But they're just trying to find something, you know, just to mess with you. And like, that's just like one example of shit that I've been through.
Someone with the boys, many Smalls times. Asked, what's the beep test? You want to explain what the beep test is?
Oh, yeah, the beep test. Yeah, so the beep test is, yeah, non-Australians wouldn't know. So the beep test basically is, so you set up cones, like on, like, say you got like a bit of grass or an area to run backwards and forth, and I can't remember how many meters it is between each line.
It used to be measured in yards, but I would say it's probably about 30 meters, but I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, it's something like that. And basically it just kind of like beeps every 1.1 beep, 1.2, and then it keeps going through different levels. It goes like, it was up to like 1.8 or something, and then it like resets. Okay, 2.1,
speeding up, right?
And it, yeah, it gradually gets faster and faster, and you have to touch your foot over the line before the beep. And if you miss one, you have to make sure you get over the line before the beep the next time, otherwise you're out, and that's your score. And it's like, how long can you keep running back and forwards with the beeps getting
faster?
Basically,
just run back and forward faster and faster and faster until you can't go anymore. And some elite scores are like over 15, but you know, a good score that you would want is somewhere probably above 10. That would mean that you've got like, you know, an average to above average level of fitness. It's a way of measuring how much you can push yourself in a cardiovascular sense.
Yeah. So I think you have to get over, to get a steel wristband in our, to get a white wristband, I think you have to score over 6, and to get a steel wristband, you have to score over 8. I think to get into Vic Pol, you only need to get over 4 point something or something really low.
You could actually,
and then if you're a woman, you
could almost walk 4. You probably have to.
Start, yeah, yeah, it's great. You'd have to be like a fat, like smoking 8 packs of cigarettes a day, just eating like KFC and McDonald's every meal, and just
Australian. Never doing any, I think the beep test is sort of
get like low 4.
How should I describe? In Australia, our culture, specifically our sporting culture, it consists of a combination of strength, speed, skill, cardiovascular health, that kind of thing. It's very demanding. Australian Football League, for example, Australian Rules Football, it's not just about being strong, being strategic, that kind of thing. It's very different from American football. It's about being agile and extremely fit, about being able to run long distances, to stop, start, to sprint, to run, to run, to sprint. and just to
also skill in hand-eye coordination.
And so I think the beep test is, I didn't know the beep test was just an exclusively Australian thing, but it doesn't surprise me that it is, because it's like, it's very demanding. It sounds simple, but it really exhausts you.
And I think they have something similar in England.
Very exhausting.
I think they have something similar in England, but they call it something slightly different, because I've done it before where it's had like an English accent and it was called something slightly different.
The beep test. The fucking beep test, mate.
They call it something else. Yeah. Anyway, really maybe someone from Britain can let us know. Katanaria said, props for another banger stream title. Yeah, obviously, this is for those of you who are...
We were talking about that before the stream started. I was saying that Joel comes up with great stream titles. There's a creative element to Joel's brain. On top of all the high IQ and all the ideas he's got, he's also really clever at coming up with stream titles. So, yeah, I agree. I agree, bro. Props. Well-deserved.
Yes, yeah, so it's a reference to, for those who don't know, Martin Luther's On the Jews and Their Lies, obviously. Yvonne626 said, hey, y'all are great and y'all are going to win. Obviously, this is someone from the American South, y'all. Blair said that old footy guy who interviewed you and Tom got mad because you interrupt a lot.
I interrupt a lot. You'll find, if you pay attention, that I often only get to speak if I interrupt. And so I've developed the habit of interrupting through that experience or set of experiences. But I try to do, I do my best to wait my turn. But how should I describe? I'm a very self-centered person, so I often just smash my idea through without waiting. But it was a bad habit that I had to work on too. So, you know, there's a bit of a balance that I'm trying to strike there.
I felt like he just picked on you because he didn't want to go at Tom, but he had to... Like, he needed to scapegoat you so that he could look like he was, like, pissed off at the Nazis. But it was a way to,
there was
like,
a few reasons. Create,
if it you was want, a way to create want, that, like, antagonism, but still, at the same time, basically give Tom a pass. Because he obviously likes Tom. You could tell in his body language. So he was he couldn't just like Tom and then just be chill about you as well. And then, from his perspective, he had to be, like, a self-righteous... Oh, these fucking, you know, pieces of shit or whatever. So we had to, like, invent. Honestly, I feel, bro, like they were sentiment.
If you don't know who Sam Newman is, he's like an Australian footy icon down here, football icon. And Tom and I were on an interview which blew up into this big fiasco in Australia a month or two ago because no one's supposed to interview us. I find it funny, though, that regardless of how censored we are, how blacklisted we are, we always manage to emerge from the depths of that censored status and get on some poor bastard's radio show. It's like, it always happens eventually. And it usually happens because they reach out. We don't even do anything. We just keep existing. And someone reaches out and says, hey, I want to interview you guys. It's like, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, we want to interview you. And we're like, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, man, let's do it. I'm like, okay, let's do it. And then they wish they didn't, you know, but it's just going to continue to happen. It's the same process over and over again. Only this time with Sam Newman.
I feel like that was just a chapter in a longer Sam Newman narrative arc. I think there's going to be more chapters in the story. That's what
I hope so. I hope so. I've never had anyone in politics, I've had people dislike me a lot. But in media, everyone I've worked with, it's been fine. It's been amicable. You know, it's never really been that hostile. No one's taken a particular dislike to me. But there's reasons why I think Sam didn't end up liking me very much. He wanted to scapegoat. He wanted sort of an easy explanation for why he was copping all the flack in the first place. So there was the scapegoat element. But there were several other parts to the story which contribute to his dislike for me, I think. He is right. He didn't actually invite me to the studio. He just invited Tom. I just drove Tom because that's what I sometimes do. I've had a lot of experience with media interviews, and sometimes Tom asks me to go just as an advisor or just for some general support, you know. Also, we like to film, if someone, one of the boys is going to go in an interview, we like to film our own copy of the exchange. So I was literally just going to do that. I did think there was a possibility I'd be invited on, and he did. He ended up saying, there's an extra seat there, mate, if you want to take it. I don't know if he was being sarcastic or not when he said that in the studio, but I just went and sat in the seat. I'm like, yeah, fuck it, I'll jump on. I just kind of impulsively agreed. There was that. But then Tom wanted to use bathroom first before we started. So Tom leaves the room. Then I tried to vibe with him a little bit. I said that my cousin plays for Carlton, my first cousin. He's a wingman, I think, for Carlton. I'm not sure. I haven't watched the game in a while. But his reaction to that was strange. It's like he understood that I was trying to vibe with him and he didn't like it. So he wasn't really willing to open dialogue with me. He just said kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. And he just stared at the table. He wasn't really willing to have a conversation, a human conversation with me. And I thought, oh, well, I didn't really mean to rub him the wrong way, but okay. But then I got my phone out and I pressed the record button and I thought I'll just audio record this whole thing just so we have our own copy of it. And I placed my phone on the table face down and he looked at it and I think he realized what I was doing. So from the beginning, he caught me trying to sort of be friendly and vibe with him a little bit and he didn't like it. Then he saw me put my phone on the table and I'm pretty sure he knew I was recording the whole thing. Then I kind of suggested that some people chop up their interviews and they don't put the live thing to air and he didn't like that either. So I think there's various reasons why he decided he didn't like me and those all contribute to the general picture senile Sam Newman ended up forming regarding my character. I don't care though. I don't really care if people don't like me. I wouldn't be in this kind of politics if I cared whether or not people liked me, right?
Your video was pretty good though. It was clear in his remarks afterwards that someone was in his ear telling him, talking shit about you, and he just like took what they said at face value. Like he's like, "Well, why did Blair put me in this edit with Nazis in it?" And
it goes to show how flaky boomers can be though, because I know a couple of people close to Sam Newman. And I was in contact with them at the time and, you know, they were trying to take credit for setting the interview up, but it was more of just a Sam Newman called Tom Sewell thing. No one else was really involved. But the couple of people I know who are reasonably close to him, they did nothing to try to defend me when he turned on me. It's like they didn't call him. They didn't say, hey, man, you've got it the wrong way around. Blair's actually – no one did anything. And I'm thinking, fucking, you know, they were friendly to me before the interview was had gone to air. But then as soon as things went sour, they weren't contactable.
Typical. I actually got a call about that interview before it happened as well.
There's always people, whenever something happens in politics or media, there's always people taking credit for it that usually actually had nothing to do with it. I've discovered that much in my time with politics.
That's definitely true. Yeah, I did get a call and said, oh, would you like to come on podcast with Sam Newman? Maybe we could get you and Blair or you and Tom. And I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. Let me know. And then I hear you and Tom are going on. And I was like, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. So there's obviously like a bunch of people that are like, because we were all over the news at the time and they're just like all working behind the scenes trying to be like the guy. And that's probably part of what frustrated Sam as well. He's probably got like all these people around him that are trying to like pull him in this direction and pull him in that direction. That's what happens with a lot of people who have status and profile. People will try and attach themselves to them and use their status and profile for their own purposes or clout or whatever. And sometimes he's obviously sensitive to that. And so then he projected that onto you, which, I mean, you were just invited, so it doesn't make any sense. But he was obviously projecting that because it must be happening to him in some capacity. There must be some capacity in which Sam is being fucked with and used by certain people, and people are in his ear trying to pull him in this direction and that direction. And it's.
Right, but look, man, at least he amended the damage he did to his reputation by getting Avi Yemeni on. I mean, now everyone thinks he's really cool.
that was embarrassing. That was tragic. He showed so much fear towards the Jews. It's like, Sam, like, you're like, what is he, like 80? Like, what are you afraid of?
Like Tom dead. Said though, like, just let been it rip, accused Tom. Of being, he's been accused of being senile, and I think I just might have said it then, but as Tom correctly stated on Mark Collett's show this morning, he's not senile, he's just 80 years old. When you're 80 years old, you think in a certain way that's a little bit slow maybe, or just like you don't really connect the dots the way you should be connecting them. It's normal stuff. But let's move on. I don't want to talk too much. I like Sam Newman. He doesn't like me, but I like him. And I feel bad what happened to the guy. I feel bad.
I like him too. To him. But I also am a bit disappointed. I think there's going to be a redemption arc, though. I think his... Because Sam Newman is a fucking racist, right? He's a fucking racist. He's on our side in his heart. You could see the way that he was looking and reacting to the things Tom was saying, that he loved it.
He's that boomer. He's that boomer to your racist, where they're like secretly racist, but they would never actually be overtly racist.
Yeah, exactly.
That's under the table racism.
But he showed so much fear towards the Jews, and it's like, Sam, they already pulled you off the television. You're gonna die soon. The country's going to shit, Sam. Like, fuck it, just roll the fucking dice. Finally, like, what have you got to lose? Like, you're on the way out. Just fucking go out in a blaze of glory. Like, tell us all what you actually really think.
No one's gonna remember you, so fuck it, right? The next super chat is from Yvonne626. Sends $5. Thanks, mate. He says, seeing what they are doing in Gaza, I wish I could bottle my current strong negative sentiments so I can unbottle them after the good guys attain power and the innocents can be properly avenged. How do you interpret that, Joel? It seems impassioned. It's an impassioned super chat. I like a super chat with a bit of passionate energy in it. I can say that much.
I personally don't give a shit about avenging Palestinians. Like, they're not my people. They're not my responsibility. And they're not doing anything to avenge any of my people that have been attacked. In fact, they don't give a fuck. So I don't give a fuck about them either. That isn't to say that I support Israel, obviously. But I'm against Israel from the perspective of what Israel is doing to us, of Israel's parasitical relationship and destructive relationship to us, or the Jews' parasitical and destructive relationship to us, regardless of the fucking Palestinians. I couldn't give less of a fuck. That's their problem to solve. Just like, I don't expect other races to swoop in and defend whites. No one's going to save us except ourselves. I fully accepted that, and that's the way that it should be. We don't deserve to exist on this planet if we can't assert our own existence and defend our own existence on this planet. That's the law of nature. I accept it. That's how God made the earth. That's how God made the universe. And who am I to argue with God? Just obey. And we will obey through strength. That's my, and that's the responsibility of the, if the Palestinians want to continue existing, or when everyone, the Muslim world wants Palestine to continue existing, well, make them continue existing. Fight. And good luck to you. But it's not our fight. It's your fight. Hedgehogs82 says, two books to help with your understanding, Twilight Over England by William Joyce and Which Way Western Man by William Gailey Simpson. Respect from England. Well, thanks for your recommendations. I have been wanting to read
Twilight then. Like, Twilight? I thought because it was like a new line after Twilight. And when I was reading it, I'm like, really? Twilight? And then, Twilight Over England.
Well, I'm not a huge, I've been wanting to read Joyce, but I haven't read almost anything by Joyce. So I've been wanting to get into Joyce at some point, but there's a long list of shit I got to read. I will get around to it eventually. Homer the Brave said, why do you think the two most powerful white nationalists, Joel and Tom, are Australian? Why is there less infighting there? And in the USA, we're addicted to infighting and losing. Is it culture or is it leadership? White fucking power. Well, I mean, these are very kind words of you to say. I think this is a very... Why do you think that there's less... Do you agree with the assessment that there's less infighting here? And what's your diagnosis of it, Blair, as someone who's obviously a veteran who's been involved in nationalist politics for a long time? It does seem like there's been a lot of infighting over the years. Maybe we're at a stage at the moment where there isn't very much infighting, but from my vantage point, that's a kind of a new development. It's not like a historical, it's not necessarily how it's always been, and probably won't always be like this, unfortunately, but it is how it is. What's your perspective?
Well, I've only been active and involved in Australian nationalist politics since 2015. So only for the past 10 years, but prior to that 2015, really, I was going to a lot of think tank meetings and trying to network within the community to find out what was happening. And so I saw what was going on behind the scenes for a while there. And it's what was transpiring there was pretty much what you would imagine happens in any series of fringe groups. They don't like each other and they don't always get on, and they spend a lot of their time talking about each other. So that was happening in Australia too. However, in Australia, we have this way of behaving, this manner, which is very against drama and melodrama specifically. We have a bit of tall poppy syndrome going on, which can sometimes be the driving factor behind splits and people having problems with each other. If you don't know what tall poppy syndrome is, it's a British expression and often a British phenomena, where when someone starts to do too well, when someone starts to succeed too much, they're actually cut down, and they're cut down often by members of their own community. And, you know, that's been a bit of an issue here in Australia probably. But I think with the phenomena of United Patriots Front, which was, I'm going to say that the driving forces behind United Patriots Front were myself, Neil Erickson, and Tom Sewell. That was a new phenomena which demonstrated that we can get popular very quickly and we can easily resonate with the public. Not only that, but when we do get popular, everyone jumps on board and offers their services, and everyone sort of networks, everyone socializes. The phenomena ends up almost resembling a national socialist type phenomena where everyone comes together and begins to develop this hive mind gang mentality, you know. So that's what happened with UPF in around 2015, 2016. Obviously, there's been serious challenges around lawfare and censorship, which have, you know, delayed our path to power after that. But there's a sense of mateship in Australia. I would have to think more about why it might be different to America, but the problem I have is I haven't seen how things happen in America. I know some people and know of some people who have been to America and have networked with people over there, so I could probably get advice from them. But I do, you know, the thing that comes to my mind immediately is that Americans seem a lot more melodramatic than Australians. And Australians, you can attack each other down here as a joke and it won't be taken seriously. There's a lot of banter. There's a lot of good faith joking going on. Everyone takes the piss out of each other. And everyone's mates at the end of the day. Even if you don't actually like the person, they're still part of a broader group of mates. That mateship is really part of the essence of what it means to be Australian. And I think that expresses itself in a social sense. It works to our advantage in fringe politics or in nationalist politics and the kind of politics we're engaged in, because we remember that even if we don't like each other, and a lot of people don't, a lot of people have reasons for why they don't like the next person who's in activism, that doesn't really matter that much. What matters is that the community continues to develop and continues to gain momentum and thrive. And obviously we've had groups that have split, and we've had groups where people have fought behind the scenes and there hasn't always been agreements. But I think what differentiates Australian movement from other movements around the world is often when splits happen, a lot of people don't talk and gossip about it. They kind of just adapt to the situation and things aren't so personal. And then something new will form, and people who had previously split, they often come back and everything gets kind of reformed. It's weird. There's not as much bad blood in Australia. The boys down here, they don't really hate each other that much and they don't make it so personal. That's been my experience, and that's why I love being Australian. That's like something that I love about our community down here, that we're all mates. We're mates too. Like we do things together. We're not just in this because we want to survive as an ethnic community, not just because we want to win. But we hang out together. We do things together. We celebrate each other's birthdays. You know, we go out and train together. We hike together. And everyone knows and loves each other. Everyone's happy to see each other. You're even sometimes happy to see that guy you don't like because he's an interesting person to have in the gang. Like, even though he's annoying, he's sometimes funny, stuff like that, not mentioning any names. But, you know, like, it's like, I don't hate anyone in Australian nationalism. I don't. I mean, I love them all. Even the people who are annoying, I still love them. And it's a great community to be a part of. I won't say anything more. I'm just going to keep rambling about how good we are down here.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when you're talking about people that we actually know, but there are people in the scene who hate us and who talk shit about us. But the thing is, the issue that they have is that no one gives a fuck about them and who they are. And they have almost like no following and no resonance. So their rants about us get read by basically no one. And so people, unless you're really like deep into the Australian nationalist scene and very aware of all these different sub-factions that no one else is aware of, you don't know that they exist and you don't know where to read their bullshit. But there are people who, you know, there's people who don't like me. There's people who don't like you, Blair, in the Australian nationalist scene. And, you know,
really? Damn.
I would question the motivations of some of them. I think some of them are motivated by personal animus, probably, but some of them, it doesn't seem to be very good faith criticism. Sometimes it's, you know, insinuations that I'm a federal agent and all this kind of bullshit based on zero evidence. So, you know, you hear it all, but, at the end of the day, I think the proof is in the pudding. You know, when I often find when people are talking shit about me on the internet, basically they're either they have the wrong impression, they saw a clip or they saw something out of context and they believe it to be true, but it's actually just false information about me. So, you know, if they sincerely believe that, then they'll probably end up realizing maybe hopefully at some point in the future that they had the wrong idea. Or it's like a personal animosity that's built upon maybe at one point I was a dick to them in some fucking capacity. And I could be an asshole. I'm a prick.
That wouldn't be true, would it? Strictly.
Yeah, I'm a prick. And that's the thing. That's one of the reasons why you can trust me. I don't blow smoke up people's asses. I don't pretend. I just say it like it is. If I like, you know, I'm movement focused. I put my cards on the table. I've had a pretty interesting life. And I've known a lot of people. I've been involved in a lot of projects, been through a lot of phases. And that's part of what makes me me. I think that's actually part of why I have value to contribute, is a kind of an interesting, dynamic, strange person. What I would say is this. I don't really give a fuck if you like me personally or if you think that I'm a shit cunt or I'm a sick cunt, whatever. I don't really care. The question is this. Do you really think that I'm not trying to do what's right by our people? If you really sincerely think that, I don't think you're paying attention. And if you don't think that, then, you know, make your disagreements gentlemanly. We don't need to be fucking shit-slinging. I don't really shit-sling at people for no fucking reason. Like, I'll say, I don't agree with this, I don't agree with that, here's why. But I'm not really picking fights, like, for no reason. You know what I mean? There's always a reason. So, nor am I really picking fights that much, because a lot of the time, I've realized this over the years. I used to pick fights more back in the day online with people in the broad scene internationally, more so than anything else. Even if you think you're right, usually the process, like if you're not having a productive argument, if you're just talking shit, the process just drags you down onto their level. And it becomes this kind of politically irrelevant, like in the racist scene or the nationalist scene, here's my argument with this random person from some other faction. If it's not really like a deep philosophical argument, like my debate with Keith Woods, and Keith Woods is my personal friend. I've known him for years. We've spent time together in real life. We're having an intellectual debate, right? It's not like a personal thing. But if you're having like a personal dispute with someone, and it's just about like, you know, spreading rumors about them or each other or exposing each other or whatever, how is this really benefiting the movement? How is this really benefiting like, shouldn't we be focusing our attacks on our actual political enemies? Like, if you have concrete evidence that someone is a Fed or concrete evidence that someone is a Jew, present the evidence, right? But if you don't actually have evidence, then what are we doing here? You know, what are we doing here? Like, we're just basically wasting our time having an irrelevant argument on the fringe here while our race is being genocided, while our country is being stolen from us. So, anyway, I think basically the reason why it seems like there's no infighting in Australia is this simple reason. The simple reason is this. Pretty much everyone in Australian nationalism who's doing anything successful at the moment is either us or people who are so focused upon whatever their sub-project, their particular project is, that they realize that they get absolutely no benefit from starting some kind of flame war with us, and they're focused upon whatever their strategy or project is and trying to achieve that, right? And good luck to them. And that's what we're focused on. That's why we don't sit here spending our time going, oh, this other faction in Australian nationalism, fuck them for this reason. We don't do that because it's irrelevant. We aren't reacting to other people. We are acting. We're setting the agenda. We'll criticize like the Liberal Party or the One Nation Party or whatever, because those are people with power and influence, and like that's like our real political enemies. We're not wasting our time arguing with internet fucking subcultures that are irrelevant, that have 50 people in them or something. Like, what is that going to achieve?
Yeah, man. We also have the kind of culture, a community. I'll wrap the subject up just with this example of what I'm talking about in a minute. We have a community of boys who will just like absolutely savage you if you kind of sink to the level of infighting. It's like we have a bit of a policy against that kind of stuff. And if you're going to try to drag things down with that bullshit, the boys will call it out pretty quickly. But I'll give you an example, because I said splits happen. I was involved in what you could describe as a pretty significant split with a group I was with years ago. I won't discuss the details of the split because it's just not beneficial to the community for me to discuss it. And I never did discuss it with anybody. I wasn't really happy about it because, you know, I loved being a part of this particular project and I thought it was going somewhere at the time. But after splitting, people were contacting me and they were asking me, what can I get involved in, Blair? I heard about this thing. What should I do? I would still tell people to join the project that I split from. I would still direct them there because I still believed in it, even though I wasn't a part of it anymore. And it was still the only really thing that was happening, the thing that was happening in Australian nationalism at the time. It was the main thing that was happening. So what was I supposed to do? Like, just for personal reasons and because I was personally unhappy, turn my back on the whole thing? No, it was still happening. It was still an active project that people could go and join. So even though I'd split from it, I wasn't doing anything. So I told people to join it still. And I never talked about it with anyone. And that's a good example of how you handle situations like that. Like, I've physically attacked someone or tried to physically attack someone who's actually quite prominent in the community still now, because I just got really angry one night. I was just tired. They said something that pissed me off and I just wanted to kill them. And I don't know, like, if I don't know what I would have done if I actually got to them, but the boys held me down and it didn't end up developing into anything. But I still love that guy. I think he's funny as fuck. Like, I still see him all. So that's just an example of how you don't let just individual circumstances, things that are happening in the moment, whatever it is, you don't let it bog you down too much. You've got to get over shit, keep moving forward and look at what's beneficial to the broader community, not what's like, you know, eating at you inside.
Sometimes you get into arguments. Like, I've had big arguments with Jacob, I've had arguments with you before, I've had arguments with Tom. We haven't come to blows. I mean, we've punched on with gloves on and stuff, like, but that's not with animosity. That's just training and competition. But when you're working on a project and your heart and soul is in something and you're, you know, and you're taking what you're doing seriously as men, there's going to be times where you're going to have heated arguments. There's going to be times where fucking you're feeling stressed and like it's high octane and, you know, you're going to have arguments. That's actually normal and healthy. If you never had big arguments, then you're a bunch of pussies. You know, you're not actually willing to put your opinion forward. And usually it ends up being for the better. Yeah, it ends up being for the better to just talk it out and fucking hammer shit out. And that's just how it works. I mean, but yeah, like that's just how men work. So anyway, the broader question though of infighting, another reason why in America there's a lot of infighting, I think, it's just simply because America's so big, and you know everyone wants to. And American culture is a bit more individualistic. In Australia, like you said, Blair, we have what is called the tall poppy syndrome, and basically what that is Australians, if you're successful in Australia, if you're high status, we expect you to humble yourself and to recognize that, you know, your success ultimately comes from a larger group of people who don't get the plaudits, and to recognize that and to humble yourself before that. And that's how Australians are. And I think that's one of the reasons why national socialism will, you know, suits Australians, actually, because Australians, we want leaders that are one of us. It's kind of, it's about the team. It's about the boys. It's not about individuals in Australian culture. And I think that predisposes us quite well to
national socialism. Individuals are impactful, but everything still needs to be about the greater good.
Well, to the group, right? Yeah, you've got to have dynamic individuals. Of course, we've got leaders. Of course, we've got leaders. But those leaders derive their legitimacy from the fact that they're serving the group.
And they're like, there with the boys. They're eating with the boys. They're marching with the boys. They're of the men. They're not like...
Exactly.
They don't consider themselves like special or removed, you know, or deserving of any special status. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're just one of the boys. And we have that in working culture in Australia too, where the builders who are really respected aren't the academic builders who only show up on site once every 2 weeks to, you know, point their finger around and act like the boss. The builders who really are respected and loved are the builders who are there working with the boys on a daily basis. I've said this before on stream, but is there anything more you want to say on this? Because we've been on this subject for a while now.
No, but that's a good point, though, that, like, I shared a video today, actually, of these two. Maybe I'll play this video, actually. It's kind of a joke, and maybe people will be offended by it because it's kind of like making a joke out of something which is quite serious. But I think it's funny, and I'll get your reaction to this because, anyway, obviously these guys are kind of soy, but it's funny bands, funny British bands.
All men are interested in the Nazis, whether they admit it or not. So what do you think is the prevailing interest in the Nazis for them? Is it more
I guess it's the biggest...
Guy time?
No, it's the biggest... It's the furthest the boys have ever got without their wives calling them on it. It's a stag do that went the furthest. It's the Nazis. That's why men are fascinated in it, because they go, God,
how'd you get away with that?
Get away? What, her indoors didn't stop you doing that? Fuck me. Wow. I think that's why we're fascinated by it. Yeah, totally.
It's the naughtiest boys who've ever lived.
Yeah, it's the naughtiest boys who've ever lived. It's basically Germans have gone to the darts at Ali Pali and never gone home. Yeah. That's what the Nazis are.
Anyway, obviously it's kind of making light and trivializing something which is a lot more serious. But at the same time, that's kind of like a funny... It is like a kind of positive take, and it is kind of funny in the sense of it's the boys being the boys. And that's kind of like, I feel like that's the energy as well of our movement. Maybe what's attractive about it is it's the lads on tour, kind of that kind of energy. And that's what the ancient Germanic war band was. Like the ancient Germanic war band, it was like whoever was the leader of the war band, he had to fight from the front. And if you're the leader of your war band, if your chief got killed, it was permanent dishonor to you. So you had to protect that man's life with your own, but he's fighting from the front. So protecting him means you're getting at the front and going hard to make sure that he survives. And basically to get all the best, you know, young athletes to join your war band, it's like, okay, well, you've got to be putting on a spread. Steaks, beers, the works. And then, you know, basically how many dudes can you have living on your property? How many mouths can you feed? How like sick is your training sessions? That's how big your war band grows. That's how the ancient Germanic war bands operated. And it was kind of like, you know, sports teams basically, but there were, you know, it was all about finding a leader who was an honorable man who you would go and serve because he put on the best training sessions and the best parties and fed you the best food and was a sick cunt basically. And then you'd want to join whatever the war band was that had all the best fighters on it. So you could be one of the boys and you could have fun with the boys. And, you know, that basically is the essence of the Germanic war band that was unconquerable by the Romans as described by Tacitus in his Germania. And, you know, I feel like there's something of that energy that we've like recreated, which is like this kind of impervious, like loyalty amongst of genuine mateship, as you describe. And I think that's very appealing. And so, for example, one day we're going to run you and probably me and many of the rest of us for office. When we run in particular you, it's like, that's an Aussie. You know what I mean? We're going to be like, this is one of the boys. And we're going to all have that energy about us because we are like this like genuine, organic expression of the Australian people. And then you look at all these contrived nerd frauds that are actually in all the other parties. And it's like, are you going to vote for someone that reminds you of your mates? Are you going to vote for someone that reminds you of your cousins, of your brothers, of the dudes at work? Or are you going to vote for some fucking faggot that you would never fucking go to a barbecue with, that you would never want to fucking sink beers with, that you can't relate to? You know, who's going to make you feel represented?
There's this unspoken understanding between the boys too. It's like, even if you're not saying everything that you're going to do, like let's say you're running for office, even if you're keeping your words small and to a minimum, it's just the look on your face. Like the boys will know this is the one, you know. It's like, this is the real deal, this guy. And, you know, that's what it's going to come down to, I think. It's going to be exciting times when we do finally do that. I'm excited for it. But
Someone in the chat said here, I love brotherhood, but we need more nationalist women involved to show Western media that we're all involved.
As long as
the way that you get women is through you organize the men, and then the women organize around the men. That's like
you have great supporters.
You have the war band, and then all the mothers and all the wives and girlfriends. Well, then they form the community around the war band. That's how the tribe forms.
Yeah.
You know, like you're not gonna. What are we gonna have, a bunch of single women that are gonna be like nationalist influencers or something? I think that's the model. I think the model is like organic, like where you have a community, like an organic community of people who are forming families, and it's a cohesive, natural community, not just like arbitrary, like here's some women, here's some men who have nationalist opinions or something. That, in my experience, is not.
You prove yourself as a woman. As a woman, you produce strong Aryan children, right? And then you're a member of the nationalist community. Motherhood is the greatest honor for women, I think. We had a really big...
Even when you're young and you haven't had kids yet, like the women in our community, a lot of the women have had children in the community, but some couples haven't had children yet. What the women provide, though, is the glue that holds the community together. Like when we have community days, they're putting this food on. They play an important role in our community as well. It isn't just like, obviously the dudes form the direction. You know, we come together, we swear oaths to one another, we're loyal to each other. That forms the fundamental foundation. But then the women are the glue that like holds the fabric of the community together and enables it to be welcoming and functional. So that's how it's supposed to be, in my opinion. That's natural. Rather, you know, it's like this contrivance. I don't want a bunch of like TikTok e-girl women that are just trying to get likes and retweets.
I don't like to make too many rules for women. Like, I think if the community is good and strong, women will organically find their role within it. And you won't have to like, you know, have this contrived set of rules that they have to follow and stuff. I'm not one of those people that likes to discuss stuff like that. You'll know if the community is good because the women will want to be a part of it. And when they are a part of it, they'll find a useful role to play within it without you having to dictate it to them. You know, it's pretty simple stuff.
Yeah, well, exactly. And like the easiest way to get women involved is to have a bunch of sexy dudes involved. I mean, it's pretty basic, but it's true. If you got hot dudes, then hot chicks want to be where the hot dudes are. So
it works the other way too, though. It works the other way. That's how.
Yeah, but I don't love the other way. I don't love the other way as much, to be honest. But like we don't want to create like simp nationalism. Where
we started the right way. We started with just the boys, and there's a bunch of girls in now too. So we started the right way, man, and it's working. As I was saying, we had a huge super chat from Testy Testerson, who sent through $100. That's very generous. Thank you very much. He says, great conversation tonight, giving us plenty to contemplate. It's given me plenty to contemplate too. You can tell I'm getting tired. I'm slurring my words, but Joel does that. Joel's a great guy to, if you've got a question you want answered, like you should pay some money to the super chats and get me to ask it to Joel, because he's a great guy to, it's great to pick his brain. He really is able to unpack and unfold a thought that you might have begun with. And then after you listen to Joel's take on it, you've got all these different, like this different level of nuance that you didn't have before. And I think we had that on the show today. We unpacked and explored the concept of, you know, the Jewish nature and exclusive intellectualism versus intellectual idealism, what that idealism means and where it comes from. It's all very cool stuff. And thanks for the super chat. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was important to discuss it because the accusation that we get often is like, oh, you guys are just obsessed with the Jews and you just hate Jews. And, you know, you can't take responsibility for the role that white people are playing in their own demise. And so you sort of blame all of your problems on Jews. Well, if you listen to what I said today, you would see that actually I was blaming our problems most fundamentally on us. I see Jews as a symptom. Jewish power is a symptom of a more fundamental spiritual disease in us. That's where I locate the problem. And the good people say, oh, don't blame white people. We should blame Jews. Otherwise, you're blaming white people for our problems. No, it's actually empowering to locate your problems in yourself, because that means you have the power to fix them. If your problems exist outside of yourself, if you're subject to another power and that power is dominating you and therefore it is responsible for your misfortune, then you're basically stuck in that position. You're too weak to do anything about it and you're just subject to a greater power, and so you just eat shit and die. Whether it's fair or unfair is irrelevant. That's basically the situation. We're not in that situation as a race. Whites are not being dominated by a superior power. We are spiritually sick. We are creating our own mess. We are creating our own problems. We're doing this to ourselves. So if we take that responsibility, that's actually empowering, because it shows that we can solve this in ourselves. We can fix this ourselves. We don't need to appeal or plead to the enemy to have mercy on us. We can take the situation into our own hands and we can win. So that's actually a powerful perspective to have, and you should want to have that perspective. And it's a true perspective, thankfully, because otherwise we'd be fucked. There's also an entropy super chat from Based Henry George, who said that he appreciates our work and sacrifice, and I appreciate that. Racist Aristocrat also said, stellar performance dismantling Greg's position. The overall debate you sparked is bearing immense fruit. On a separate note, I exhort the listeners to watch Dries Van Lagenhove's 2023 American Renaissance speech, and to support his Give, Send, Go, The Enemy Fears Our Global Solidarity. And yes, Dries, I haven't ever done a podcast with him, but I've spoken to him before on Twitter. We were in group chats together. He's a Flemish or Belgian, obviously, like the Flemish are part of Belgium. He's a Flemish nationalist, Belgian activist, and he's done a lot of great work, standing up for his people, working in the nationalist scene there. And he collaborates a lot with other activists from across Europe and the Western world. And he's undergone incredible legal pressure. You think our laws are bad. The laws in Belgium are even more fucked. The policing in Belgium is even more fucked than it is in Australia. He stands up against that. I think he's been to prison before. He's sentenced to go to prison again. He's got active court cases, but nothing's going to stop him. He's a man of supreme willpower. I wish I knew more about him. I think in time I will learn more about him, but from what I've seen, I'm very impressed and supportive. So yeah, full respect to him, and people should study his speeches, because he's a man in the arena. But yeah, I think that's basically all the super chats for the evening, and that's the show for the evening. I hope that people enjoyed the show, and we'll see you all next week. And like I said, Monday morning Australia time, Sunday night British time, and Sunday afternoon I think American time, I'll be on with Mark Hollett, so watch out on social media for that. And you can go and watch Tom with Mark. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can go and watch Tom's interview by Mark this morning on Mark Hollett's Rumble and Odyssey and so on. So go check that out if you haven't seen it as well. And we'll see you guys all next time.
You guys should watch that one, by the way. It's the first ever interview Mark's done with Tom, and it was pretty good. As usual, Tom provides great insight. So yeah, like I said too, just to remind you guys, we've got a new idea in the works for next week's stream, which should be pretty fun. I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, I suppose for now we'll sign off. We'll see you guys next week.